This is an interview with Ann Braden by Tracy Kaymire, conducted on June 7th, 2001. This is our second session.
Try to remember something.
Yeah, a little bit up there. And, okay, like I said, I'd like to start off by asking you, were you involved personally in any of the events that led up to school integration in Louisville?
Oh, yeah. Well, not the... Oh, God, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not the... what the school board did, which I think was for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
But did we talk about the Committee for Democratic Schools?
No, that's actually where I'd like to pick up.
Yeah.
Because I've seen that name in your papers.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember exactly how it started. It seems to me it kind of grew out of the interracial hospital movement. It was people we knew through that. So. Mm-hmm. And I know that... that Purdue was involved. Mm-hmm. Reverend Purdue. And Reverend Hewlett, and I can't, and people from the Progressive Party, I guess, which had pretty much fallen apart by then. I can't remember exactly when, but it was before the Supreme Court decision. But it must have started. That was in '54, of course. And we had a hearing in Frankfurt in the, I think, March of '54, maybe. So I think it had either started in the fall of '53 or possibly that spring. But I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But in there somewhere. And so I can't remember a meeting where it took place or anything, but it was just a few people got together
mm-hmm.
and formed a thing we called the Committee for Democratic Schools. I can't remember when J.C. Olden died. We talked about him.
Yeah, and I know it's right around in this period somewhere.
Yeah, because they had
a... on the stuff for the Democratic Schools that much.
Well, he may have been dead by then. I know it was in the winter, because I remember Carl spoke at his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Had a big funeral, and you know he never was known in the white community hardly at all. Mm-hmm. It was funny, but he was quite a figure. But he died, and that was a real loss because he'd sort of taken the lead on so many things. And it may have been as late as January '54. I kind of think it was somewhere along in there. But so he may have been around when this started. I don't know. But anyway, we got up a petition, and I bet the petition is probably in my files at Wisconsin somewhere because we. Got it to circulating in the churches, and it was for repeal of the day law, basically. And we wanted the schools integrated. And we got a lot of support, actually. I got a lot of petitions signed, I remember that. I can't remember where all we got them signed. But I guess mostly through churches. And I'm trying to think who they would, I don't even remember who the petitions were to, whether it was to state government some way, because it was repeal of, to the legislature and the governor, I guess. And trying to think who the governor was. He was, because, do you remember who was governor in 54?
Yeah, the 50s would have been...
Well, when we had the demonstration in Frankfurt, took the petitions on the hospital thing to Frankfurt, but that was earlier. That was Weatherby.
Yeah, Weatherby.
But by then, by 54...
So it's whoever's between Weatherby and Chandler.
Well, it wasn't Chandler. Now, Chandler came in about 56, so somebody came in 52, and that's who it was. Now, who is it? Because whoever it was, you see, announced immediately after the Supreme Court decision that Kentucky would comply.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, we should remember that. I should remember, but it's just gone out of my mind. I get those governors mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
But we always thought that the kind of work that was done around there helped prepare the atmosphere around this committee. And we had some support out in the state, especially in Berea, had... helped make it possible for him to make that announcement, see, because other states were coming out and saying massive resistance,
mm-hmm.
and Kentucky never did.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we finally got, I don't remember exactly what we did with the petitions, but we got a legislator to introduce a bill to repeal the day law. It had already been modified, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Johnson case was way before that, but and then had I guess after that decision in the Johnson case that I can't remember, the legislature amended it as it applied to graduate education,
mm-hmm.
maybe,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know whether it applied to undergraduate or not, I can't remember, but along about that time was when University of Louisville desegregated, because they knew that the NAA was getting ready to file a lawsuit, that's why they did it, and I've forgotten what year that was.
51.
That was 51, so that was by that time, the day law had been changed as it applied to higher education generally. So this was only for high school on down.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a legislator to actually introduce a bill, which we knew wouldn't pass, but that gave an excuse to have a public hearing, and we had a great public hearing in Frankfurt. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was Senator McCann who introduced the bill. And I remember that name, I think, and I don't know why that pops into my mind if it wasn't him. He'd been in there, and he was kind of a maverick guy, because he was there, I know, when I was working on the paper, he was always making some statement that was quotable, and people, he got quoted a lot. But I think he's the one who introduced that bill. And I'm not even sure we had any black legislators then. I don't know who it would have been. We'd had Charlie Anderson. He got killed somewhere. Well, no, he wasn't.
He was so odd, but he was not in the legislature anymore. Felix Anderson, I think, was in there by then?
I don't know.
Not related, obviously, but yeah, Felix Anderson was also in at the same time. But so McCann was white? I wasn't sure
about
that.
White. No, he was white.
And he was from the...
McCann, I think. It's C-A-N-N.
Yeah,
McCann, I think,
sorry.
You know, don't put that in print or anything until you would check it, because I'm just pulling it out of my unconscious. But I kind of think he did. And I don't quite know how we got him to, but he did. Anyway, I remember the hearing, and we got people to go, and a lot of people went. And I've got a picture of it. The reason sometimes you remember these things because pictures, because I wrote it up for the Southern Patriot, which that was long before Carl and I worked for SCEF, and it was before we even knew Jim Dombrowski, but we'd gotten linked up with SCEF really through Al Mond, who worked at the Courier-Journal on the copy desk with Carl, and was very close to Jim Dombrowski and edited the Patriot, which was just a little thing the size of the Alliance newsletter now, you know. But so I began writing a few things for him from Kentucky, and I wrote a story about that hearing, and there was a picture. I forget who took it, because we didn't get as many good pictures in those days as we did later. But somebody took a picture in that hearing, and it's in the Patriot files. So, and you can see Hewlett there and different ones. But then the Berea had already opened to blacks, you see, as soon as the day law changed so they could, since it had been passed aimed at them anyway. So there was a bunch of black and white students came to the hearing from Berea and talked about how much better the campus was now that it was integrated, you see. So that was good. And I forget who else testified. I didn't. I mean, we were, you know, Carl and I weren't as much pariahs then as we became later, but we were still sort of radicals. I mean, we were radicals, so we didn't really get out in front too much. But I'm pretty sure Hewlett testified, and I think Perdue. I can't remember who was white that testified. Now, Manser.
Were labor leaders involved too? I mean, was labor
I don't
still
remember
involved?
Any. I don't That's remember right. any labor leaders on that. Now, there may have been some, and by that time, I think the Harvester Union had pretty much been taken over by the UAW and was not the same as it had been before. You know, and they lost that strike, and the UAW won. So I don't really remember that there was. Okay. There was a guy named Manser Tidings. You've probably run into that. And he was later, what was he doing then, head of the some sort of Human Relations Council, which was non-governmental. And he later became, I guess, the first director of the Kentucky Human Rights Commission when that was set up, which was actually set up in the 50s, wasn't it? They didn't have any laws to enforce until later, but they were set up. He became, I think, director of that, or was it the Louisville? No, he became head of the Louisville one. That's what it was. It was the Louisville one.
But at this time, he was but the that was Kentucky Council on Human Relations.
Right. So, yeah, maybe maybe he was never with the Kentucky Commission. That was Galen Martin from the beginning. He was he became the first director of the Louisville Commission, which wasn't set up until after the sit-in, so that was 60s. So I guess all through this period, I guess that's what he was doing. He was scared to death of Carl and me. But, you know, he couldn't avoid his paths crossing with ours sometimes. And I remember we were organizing to get people over to Frankfurt to that hearing, and I remember he called up and talked to Carl. He said, I've been trying to get in touch with you or something, because he was also trying to work on this bill. So I think he found himself having to work with us whether he wanted to or not. So I can't remember whether he testified or whether maybe he got some people there. Anyway, it was good, and it got a lot of good, even local publicity as well as other things. And what we wanted was the schools desegregated from top to bottom. And then when, and I think, I'm pretty sure that was in March, you see, which was right before the House thing and when we got involved in that, in March. And then in May, the Supreme Court decision came down. And and see, our kids were preschool then. And I got it. I was determined that my children weren't going to a segregated school. That was my motivation on that. I didn't want them in a segregated school to grow up as little white children, not knowing anything but little white children. So, but then after the house thing all started, obviously that sort of consumed our lives. So, and I don't know what happened to the Committee for Democratic Schools. I think it fell apart after that. But and didn't really play any role in the shaping of what Louisville did, which it would have been good if it had, I think. And maybe if our case hadn't come along, we'd have kept it going and done that, you know. Because then what happened is, you know, I was so elated when the Supreme Court decision came down, because I really thought the schools were going to be integrated the next fall. I mean, and I wasn't the only person. Like Fred Shuttlesworth told me later, he thought that too. Yeah. I mean, we thought we'd won.
Right, yeah.
You know, and we were going to be integrated the next fall. And, of course, my oldest child was just 3 then. So he was due to start the kindergarten in about 2 years. But anyway, the Supreme Court then said it was going to issue a further order, which it did a year later with the whole deliberate speed thing. So nothing had much had happened. Now, and then here, let's see, when they finally desegregated, they certainly didn't integrate, was 56, right? Mm-hmm. 56, wow. Yeah. And 51, 56. That was the year that Jimmy, our son, was to start to kindergarten. Mm-hmm. He was 5. And there were... So that year, you've read Omar Carmichael's book.
Yeah.
Which I think is phony, was a $3 bill.
Uh-huh.
And you see, Louisville got all this attention about how great it was because... It wasn't violence like that. Now, when was Sturgis?
Same year, actually.
Same year.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we were kind of involved in that, too. I wrote that up for the Patriot and went down there and met some people after. And then we were in touch with people in Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an article about that because there were 2 ministers in Henderson who really did a great job of staving off what had happened in Sturgis where there was violence, you know. And there was a white citizens' council in Henderson, and they organized a movement to counter that in Henderson, and which was quite effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember writing that story, and I don't know, it's in the Patriot Files if you want to read it. So I'd gone down and met them, and one of the guys was, I can't think of his name, but it'll come to me because I saw him. I guess one of them has died, but one of them stayed there for a while. We lost touch later, but he got active in SCEF after that, and then he was here at my birthday party 2 years ago, or a year ago. And I can't think where he heard about it or anything else, but he's living with his wife down. He was a United Church of Christ minister. Living with his wife down in the retirement community, Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, where the people live that gave us the money for this building some years ago. And we were talking about the Henderson in those days. So Henderson and Sturgis were the same year. And Little Rock wasn't until a year later.
Yeah.
But there'd already been... There was trouble in Clinton, Tennessee that year.
Yeah.
I think that was 56.
Mm-hmm.
My school
mm-hmm.
was blown up or something.
Mm-hmm.
So there were several trouble spots. And that got to be, so that's the reason I get mixed up on the years. Every fall we knew there was going to be a crisis somewhere, you know. So Louisville was peaceful, and that looked pretty good compared to bombing a school and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it got a lot of attention. And then what, I haven't read Omar Carmichael's book in years, but what he got a lot of credit for... going around and preparing the community for this process, right? And he did. He went, but that's what I always objected to. He went around talking to community groups and so forth. And the message was very clearly, I don't like this any better than you do, but it's the law of the land and we got to put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that was outrageous. And I think, and I thought it at the time, that's not just hindsight, although I've thought about it in recent years when we got with all the stuff now about how desegregation hadn't worked very well for the black students. And you got all these white people running around now saying, don't take your students away from my students. You know, this has meant so much to the white students, which it has. It's done more for the white students than the black students.
Mm-hmm.
But if some of those voices like that had been speaking out in the white community then, the difference it could have made, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And And he could have, you know, instead of going and saying things like that, he could have said, look, we've got the best opportunity we ever had to give our kids a really democratic education and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, he could have done that, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that what happened was that, and then they sent out a letter. They redistricted the city. You probably know all this. To because we, you know, we had white and black schools. Mm-hmm. They redistricted the city and to eliminate those lines. And I can't even remember what was happening in the county. There weren't many blacks in the county, so it wasn't a factor, I guess. But and then they sent out a letter to all the parents of students. I can't remember whether we got a letter. Because our child would have been going to kindergarten. They cut the kindergartens out that year. I don't know that that had anything to do with integration, but they did, lack of money or something.
Oh, really? So, I didn't know that.
Out of the park. They came back later, and I can't remember when they came back. But so Jim, our son, went to kindergarten. Some of the teachers that had taught at Virginia Avenue, which is where he would have gone, is now Carter at 36 in Virginia, started a kindergarten over across the street in a church. So he went there. So I'm not sure we got one of the letters, but they sent a letter to anybody who was in the schools and maybe first graders enrolling and saying, you know, the Louisville schools will be desegregated next year. Your child has been assigned to such and such a school. If you would prefer he attend another school, please list your choices 1, 2, 3 on the back.
Mm-hmm.
So they encouraged a massive transfer, which happened.
Mm-hmm.
And like you see, we were in, are you familiar with the West End? I can't remember where you are.
Fair,
a little bit.
Barely.
But where we live on, I don't know if you've ever been to my house, where we live on Virginia
Avenue.
You
live on Virginia Avenue, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we were in the Stephen Foster district, which was the white school.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that they're getting ready to build a new one now. It's the same building still there. And it's now Stephen Foster Academy. And then the black school for that area was Virginia Avenue. So, you know, if the desegregation order hadn't happened, that Jim would have been assigned to Stephen Foster. As it was, he would be assigned to Virginia. Except there wasn't a kindergarten that year. But that's the kind of thing that was going on, see. So that you please list your choices 1, 2, 3 on the back. So I think to put the best face on it, that the school officials saw that as sort of a safety valve. You know, if some parent was going to lose their mind, let them go on transfer, which might have been all right if they'd let them take the initiative, but doing that by letter really gave the impression the school board really wants you to transfer to where you're in a majority, you know. And there was a massive transfer. I think I remember the figures because it was so appalling at the time. As I recall, 85% of the white kids applied to transfer to out of schools that had been black. And I think it was something like 45% of the black.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a... And I know I talked to people in my neighborhood, and there were still... that neighborhood was still... my block was mostly white then. It was in the later 50s that blacks began to move into that block. And later 50s, too, when there were new houses built across the street from us, where the old fairgrounds was, but none of that had happened. So right there and up there, you may have told you before, right up the street was a black block, you see. It was checkerboard. And we had thought it would become integrated. That's why we wanted to go there, so we could live in an integrated neighborhood with our kids. But so there were mostly white people around. And I talked to people who had their kids in school, and definitely that kind of pressure was working because they said, well, they didn't care. They didn't mind their children going to school with Negroes, I guess they would say in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like this is the way the schools want school system wanted it to be. So they really felt that. There wasn't any doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had very little desegregation actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And and it was, and you know, it's just sad. I think it was and that was the same way, I'm sure, everywhere, except in other places you had the massive resistance. You had schools closing, and you finally had more white people coming out in sort of a moderate movement to save the school systems, not so much for integration, but to save the school systems. That happened in Little Rock, and it happened in Prince Edward County in Atlanta, and other places. And then you had this great rash of private schools being set up, and we didn't have that here so much. The Catholics, as I recall, did a good thing then. That was during busing. Where they said they wouldn't let people come there as a haven for busing. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know whether they are.
Yeah, Pat Delahanty told me that story.
Yeah, I don't think they did anything in the 50s. But but...
No, they did open their system. They did integrate their system at the same, roughly the same time.
Yeah, well, it may have become more integrated, I don't know. But the schools in Louisville didn't very much.
Right.
And then, of course, as you know it, over time, they became more... That some schools began to, you know, by the 60s, began to get more like male. Got more and more black students, finally. And then they were beginning to shift to be majority black and stuff. But the amount, I think, in all the studies and stuff that the Human Rights Commission kept doing, finally, in the 60s, they were getting more desegregated, which brought on the suit in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and then there was a big struggle around that we did help on that some. By this time, I think it was toward the tail end of the Wade case and stuff, when we were kind of had a little bit of time again, over teacher integration. And the Defender sort of led that. Mm-hmm. If you're up to there, they had a whole series of articles.
You can definitely tell that they're pushing that.
Mm-hmm. Was Frank Stanley Sr. still there then,
yes.
I think?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of his passions.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran a series of articles, as I recall. And I know that we were doing some things on that. But that time, that was a little later in the 50s, I think, and our son was in school. Because he went to kindergarten that year, and then he went over to Virginia Avenue for the first grade. And he was the only white child in that school.
Really?
Uh-huh. Because everybody had transferred out. And actually, that's a good example, because in that area then, that could have changed, there was enough racial mixture that if people had stayed put in the districts that they were assigned to,
mm-hmm.
it would have been about half and half.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, this, as I say, I don't think it was in... Well, some people probably really were repulsed by the idea, but mostly it was just kind of the psychology of this is the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they transferred out. So we kind of, I got involved sort of in the PTA there and stuff, and we were very much involved later. I was for some years real involved in the PTA there. And, you know, we had a lot of battles with the school board because we were trying to get resources for that school. And we finally got a library. We didn't have any library. And we kept going out there to see them, and we finally got a library.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still there. They changed the name of the school later to Jesse Carter. And actually, when my daughter died, she was in the fifth grade there. And so we had people, rather than sending flowers, give books to that library, and they had a little sort of a memorial to her in the library then. I don't know whether it's still there or not. But we got the library, and we began. And they did put an addition on the building and stuff, and we got some things done for that school.
So the teacher integration stuff, like I said, I'm just getting up to that, I think, because I've just noticed
I think that first year there was no shifting of teachers at all. There was no teacher desegregation.
As of 1958, there still hasn't been.
But somewhere along in there, in the late 50s or early 60s, as a result of that agitation, that, as I recall, the Defender played a major role in, and I can remember being at some meetings about it. I can't remember exactly how it was organized.
Mm-hmm.
There was some community pressure too. I can't remember whether the NAACP was in. I think they were somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, at some point they did begin to desegregate the teachers,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be a disaster in a way for schools like Virginia Avenue,
mm-hmm.
because we realized later. My two older children went there, and then my youngest child, who was born in 60, so she must have been about 66 when she went to Virginia Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And she went there for 6 years, because that's the way it was divided then.
Mm-hmm.
Before she went, and she, by that time the Brown School had started, so she went to the Brown School. But she, but the school had changed totally in
mm-hmm.
terms of the teaching quality, because what had happened, they had really good teachers, my Jim and Anita, both had just really great teachers, and they had been bled away by the integration process, because and I realized it at the time that there was just, it was a racist sort of thing. It was this unconscious assumption only the best black teachers could teach those little white children out in the suburbs. And of course they didn't have to go,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think a couple of them did stay, preferred to stay there, but that were pretty good. But they. It seemed like getting up in the world, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Because we lost the really good teachers. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear other people in the black community talk about that, too, that the desegregation process bled their schools of the good teachers
mm-hmm.
as they went out to the suburbs.
That's interesting.
And And of course, there were a lot of places, and I don't know whether this happened there. I can't remember here, where I don't know that it did as much. Well, it did because they began closing some of the black schools too.
Mm-hmm.
That you had a decrease in the number of black teachers because black schools were closing.
Mm-hmm.
That happened extremely so in out more in the rural areas. I think where maybe there wouldn't be but two schools, and they closed the black one.
Right. Yeah.
And but you know. And then they would send us at Virginia Avenue. We had a lot of young white teachers, and the school was still predominantly black. It stayed black really mostly for the whole time my children were there. Of course, now it's a traditional school. You got all these little white kids coming in from the suburbs to it now.
But it's one of the traditional schools.
It's a traditional school, and my granddaughter went there for the first grade, first and second grade. And they moved away from here then, but it was a different atmosphere. It wasn't nearly as good an atmosphere as before, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, and which was not that long ago. Well, it's been quite a while in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd send these new teachers there, sort of learning on them, and they'd been perfectly well intentioned and maybe good teachers eventually, but they were new. So it was different from having those really. And you did have probably some of the most outstanding minds in the black community went into teaching in those days. You know, that's been pointed out a lot. And I think there's a certain romanticism now among a lot of African Americans of let's go back to those days, which you probably can't go back to. You're not going to have those teachers now and stuff, you know. But there was an atmosphere. Virginia Avenue was a good school, and they had a wonderful principal. She's still living. That woman's
Evelyn
in her 90s, Miss Jackson, Evelyn Jackson.
I didn't get her, actually.
Did you?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, she was there the whole time my children were. Mm. Let's see. No, the first year, Mr. Ligon was there when Jim was there, and then she came when Jim was in the second grade, and she was still there when Beth was there, and I can't remember when she retired. But
I interviewed her last Christmas, and she's still.
Mm-hmm. I saw her recently. She'd lost a lot of weight. She was always heavy, but she'd been sick. But she was out at something. Oh, she came down. They had something for. She was real good friends with the Meeks for Reginald. They live right across the street.
Right. Yeah.
For Reginald Meeks at City Hall. And she was down at that. And she looked real perky.
Mm-hmm.
But she was. She probably can't tell now. She was a very strong figure, and she was really was a kind of a stern person with the kids. But she was really good, and she cared about. She really worked with the teachers, and she. Cared about those children, and there was a real caring atmosphere, and she was wonderful to my children, but that wasn't just, well, and partly, you know, because, when they were there was when we were so under attack, and I know one morning she called me up, and there were some people with the cameras out taking pictures of the children, but they happened to be friends of ours who were making some kind of a movie about our case and some other things. It was, you know, after kind of things were over, but they were out there, and she wanted me to know it, and I said, yeah, I know them, it's okay. She said, well, I'm not going to let anything happen to those children. So she was very protective of them, you know. But they got really good preparation there. It was an excellent school.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a nice atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've looked back on it, and I think, you know, I can sympathize with these people who are saying, let's go back to our neighborhood schools because something was lost, you know.
Right, yeah.
And I think as I've thought about it, I never thought about it at the time, and I don't know that anybody else did because I never read it commented on it at the time, but when you really look back on it, the Supreme Court decision, as historic as it was a racist decision.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever think about that? Because it was actually I read it back again a few years ago when we were working on the Central High School case because we filed an intervention in that, the Alliance did, to try to get the court to deal with the equal education thing and the achievement gap and all that. And that they could do that. And so I went back to the original purpose of the Supreme Court decision, which wasn't, that decision does not mention the word diversity, or that it's that what we're trying to do is diversify and prepare students to live in this interracial world and all that, which people talk about now, and is a good goal, but that wasn't what it was about at all. It never says anything like that. Well, I don't even remember the word diversity being in the vocabulary then, you know. But basically, it's because it was based on the fact that these black kids were being denied their constitutional rights to an equal education. That was the purpose, an equal education. And that's what we're claiming now, that they hadn't gotten. But in the course of it, and there's something we quoted about in the decision about this, that when they said there's no such thing as separate and equal, but equal in effect, they said mm-hmm. that, because the very fact of segregation puts a badge of inferiority on black students. And of course, we were arguing in the court just a few years ago that the very fact of saying that you can only have white majority schools and blacks can't be in the majority anywhere, that puts a badge of inferiority. We said they're doing the same thing in a different way, so that's mm-hmm. why we're quoting the decision. But when you read the decision, you realize that it's all, what it's also saying is that what is white is better.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the inherent notion of it, you see, that that blacks weren't getting equal education, and they would if they were in the schools, the white schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true that most of the black schools had very inferior physical facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to somebody in the last few years that grew up in North Carolina, where their school, she said, was better than the white one physically. So that wasn't true everywhere, but generally it was true. I mean, blacks got hand-me-down books and all that kind of thing. So that was true for the physical
mm-hmm.
things. But when you look into it and the kind of experience I had at Virginia Avenue, and I know people who've talked about their experiences in these segregated schools in recent years, now grown or middle-aged, you know, that there was definitely a caring atmosphere in those schools for the students. Now, that's probably not true everywhere, but I think it was general that white schools didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
My point is that the white... These schools have something to give each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We might have had a different situation. Of course, that's Monday morning quarterbacking
right.
40 years later. But
it's interesting in Louisville because when you look especially at the high schools, I mean, and it is documented and admitted by the school board at the time that there were more, that the level of education of black teachers was higher than white teachers.
In
on
those,
average,
in that,
there were
in
more
that,
degrees,
at that time.
More advanced
mm-hmm.
degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very urban phenomenon, though. That wouldn't be true if you went into rural.
No, that's true. Well, that's the sort of at the educational level. But also, I think, the atmosphere. And maybe
mm-hmm.
because there was that sense of community in the black community that we have to, that there really is that it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
I hate to say it.
Yeah.
But that there was that attitude of,
mm-hmm.
oh, these are all our children.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that. And, I, you know, you hear any number of here African-Americans who are middle-aged now, so that's the way they grew up, that they knew they had to mind the woman down the street as well as their mother. Yeah, I think that was definitely true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was true in the schools, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing, I was in a meeting back a few years ago, and we were talking about the sad situation in schools here, and it just kind of stuck with me that T-Bone Walker, he's the minister out here at Gethsemane, I don't see him much anymore, didn't see him much then, but he was talking about the sad situation he thought was in. He said what he was worried about was not the ones that were exceptional. They were getting into these better schools. They would make it anywhere. There's always a few people, you know, that will.
Mm-hmm.
And not even the ones that were maybe way behind because there seemed to be programs trying to help them. It's the ones in the middle, the average students. And he said that because he thinks back to his own education, and that what made him, I can't remember where he grew up, I don't think he was in Louisville, but what made him push ahead, of course he went into the ministry and all that, he's pretty well educated, he's sort of a scholar, he's,
mm-hmm.
he teaches out at the Presbyterian Seminary there, maybe the Baptist Seminary, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always some teacher that was telling him that you can do this if you want to, and I really believe in you and you can do it. And he said, what bothers me is nobody is saying that to our children today,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not true either. Maybe some schools they are. But in general, that's just not there. And I think it was there then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was something that the black schools had that nobody was thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's interesting. And
so now, you know, and you look at what's happened, and you know, you hear all this about how desegregation has failed. And I, you know, I don't know. I really would like to see a study. And I guess, I don't know whether there's been a book recently. In recent years, there must be somebody working on some.
Mm-hmm.
Just a whole study of all over the South. I know the Southern Regional Council has kept
mm-hmm.
up with those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they've done a book recently. And they've tried to follow it. And it varies from place to
it's
place.
It's pretty high. Actually, in academic, historical academic history circles, there's been a number of books sort of reevaluating school integration and talking about school integration. lately. I haven't kept up with that reading as much as I should, I have to admit.
I'd like to find out more, but like I really don't know even what's happening in Aston, where I grew up, that much. I know that they closed the black high school. They only have one high school, but there again, they have a private academy where the more upper-class whites
go. Right.
And so that's happened a lot of places. But
I was thinking that that's, wanted to try to, I guess I was just looking at my watch thinking, if you want to get through the 50s, I wanted to ask some sort of general questions about the 50s before we move on to kind of the early 60s. One question I had is just in general from that time period, when you look back on Louisville and again in the 50s, what would you say were the important groups and individuals who were active at that time and who were doing civil rights stuff?
50s?
In the 50s, yeah. Again, just to sort of wrap up the 50s before we move on.
Oh, I think the NAACP, although I don't remember it in exactly what it was doing the whole time, because I guess, you know, after 54, the whole case did absorb us, and then we got so isolated, and we couldn't really be active in things here because people were scared of us. Perdue wasn't. I mean, he was always absolutely outspoken, you know, in supporting anything we did. And I guess that thing that you're talking about, Shuttlesworth, came down. And I don't even remember that, but I guess we probably were a major part of organizing it with them. And they would do things like that. Who'd you say?
Perdue, Hewlett, and Tucker.
Yeah, well, they were the ones that we sort of continued to work with. They were never afraid. They were both. They all went on this. I think they all joined the SCAF board at some point.
They're listed as on SCAF.
Yeah. And Eubank Tucker, he was a maverick. You see, he was one of our lawyers. Nothing ever scared him. Mm-hmm. His wife, of course, was later elected to the legislature.
Yeah, that's the first name. What's her first? Amelia?
Amelia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
She only served one term, and I can't think
of
it.
I'm actually interviewing Neville Tucker in August.
Are you?
Yes.
Well, he was, you know, of course, he was, I don't remember him then, but he was a major sort of player in the 60s.
Right.
And got run out of town. No doubt about it. I mean, they framed him on tax charges, but they really wanted to get rid of him because he got elected police judge. First time we'd had anybody on the bench of the police court that was treating people like human beings. He was a good judge. But he was the lawyer that was handling so many of the cases with Dan Taylor and Bob Delahaye.
Right.
But that was 60s.
Right.
But in the 50s, Tucker stayed active and stayed in touch with us. And there were things like that that, you know, we could do. But I'm trying to think what else was around. Well, there was that Council on Human Relations that Mansur Tidings had, which we were never involved in because he was scared of us. I'm not sure we would have been anyway. We might have.
It's a little
I don't know. What else? What else?
I
can't think of what else there was. Did you run across anything else?
Not any major groups. That's, you know, because like the militant church movement just
I think after Owen died that pretty much disappeared as an entity, although Perdue had been pretty key to it, but I don't think he tried to keep going. He had his own church as a base.
And Tucker had this thing called the Kentucky Bureau of Negro Affairs, but it sort of seems to be just kind of him, basically.
That's the kind of thing he would do. Yeah, he was a rugged individualist.
Yeah. So it does seem, at least, you know, when you read The Defender, now The Defender is a pretty NAACP kind of leaning paper at that time, and so it heavily reports what they're doing and not, so it's hard to know, does that mean that there isn't anyone else, or does it mean that they're just covering?
Well, there was, I just don't remember other things. Now, there could have been, but I don't think so, because you didn't have a youth movement yet. Now, they had an NAA youth council, I'll come back to that in a minute, which really wasn't visible that much until the demonstrations at the Brown Theater, which you know about.
Mm-hmm.
But it had been around before that, but I don't know exactly that they were particularly out in the community active. So I don't know of any youth groups in the black or white community that were dealing with this.
When did CORE get here?
Well, that was after the sit-in started nationally.
Oh, okay. So after February 1960.
Len Holt came. He was a friend of ours, and he was working for CORE.
Okay.
And they never had a big membership here, but they became kind of visible because they did the first sit-ins here.
Uh-huh.
And, but that would have been in 61, I think. No, wait a minute, 61. No, by 61... 61 was when the big demonstration
happened. Yeah.
Well, it was before that. It would have been, it was then, sit-in started in 60. It was probably that summer or fall that he came here. It may have been, that's interesting. I don't know.
And then how did you know him?
Well, Len Holt.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter from him. I haven't opened yet. He's, and you know, it reminded me of it. He's in the Bay Area, California. You know, I don't remember. He was a lawyer in Norfolk. He had two law partners, and they were into everything in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But he left there. He was traveling around. and some way got linked up with CORE.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just linking up with whoever he could to get something done.
Mm-hmm.
And also really brought the Lawyers Guild into the South. He, mm-hmm. he was responsible for that.
I think he has a book. Doesn't he have a book?
Well, he wrote a book. He wrote a couple of books. He wrote a book about the Freedom Summer, the summer that never ended, or that won't end, or something
okay.
like that, very soon after the 64 summer. And I'm trying to think what the other one was. But nothing that, it's not anything that really tells his history, I don't think. It's
okay.
about other things, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just because I saw him listed in a bibliography.
Oh, yeah, I can't think what that other book is. But I'm trying to think, I don't know whether he just came here, because... or whether we knew him before he came. He stayed at our house when he came, I know that. But everybody else did too, began to then. Of course, things like that were just beginning then.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him being there and trying to get CORE started here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we put him in touch with Purdue and them, and Tucker. Tucker sort of began to be a part of CORE.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tucker, I don't think, ever got along with the NAACP, so he was just looking for something else to link to.
Mm-hmm.
And some way, Beverly Neal got involved in CORE. And then some white kids, you see, who, you know, the ones we've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
Lynn Fuel and
Bernie McHugh.
And this guy, K.D. Kerr. You never did find him, did you? He would love to talk. He was such a talkative guy, and I just wonder where he is.
He was a little older, though.
He was a little older.
Yeah,
they were high school. He was older.
Okay.
But they were all in CORE. Dr. George Kimbrough, who had his office right down the street here, was in it. So it was mixed ages.
Mm-hmm.
And they began, I think probably because the NAACP wasn't picking up much on the sit-ins here. And they were happening all over by that time. You had this whole thing going on. And I think they formed it to have an action group. And they began to have some sit-ins and all that kind of stuff and began the
mm-hmm.
small sit-ins that led to the whole explosion in February of 61. But Raoul Cunningham, who you've talked to,
mm-hmm.
right, told me recently, I didn't remember this, and I'm not sure about his memory being right, but he said that he was with the NAA Youth Council.
Right.
Sort of grew up in it or
mm-hmm.
joined it when he was 14, and that was in the mid-50s sometime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe he was head of it. But he was, and then Beverly, he said, was chair of CORE, and she may
mm-hmm.
have been.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember how she really got involved, because she was Sterling's daughter, and Sterling was inactive by then. So I'm not sure how. But Raoul says that he and Beverly got together. There was all kinds of jealousies with the NAACP, didn't want to deal with CORE. Apparently the adult NAACPs weren't anxious for the youth to do anything
mm-hmm.
much. And that he and Beverly got together and linked them up, the NAA Youth Council and CORE.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but that was after. Yeah, I'm sure that was after, because the first sort of, at least the first thing I knew about, a visible thing they did was that picket at the Brown Theater.
Yeah, that was the Youth Council.
That was the Youth Council.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't any CORE then. That was 59.
Yeah.
So that was before.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Unitarians had a social action committee. And that was where the whites came from. Well, that picture we have of that picket line has Henry Wallace in it.
Right.
Well, Henry was always out wherever anything was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But and Carla's with him, a little girl, in the picture. But a number, I don't think they're in that picture I have, but there were a number of white Unitarians came out and joined that thing, and there was something, it was called the Social Action Committee or something, the Unitarian
Church.
That's
the Porgy and Bess demonstration. Mm-hmm. That's the
mm-hmm.
summer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And maybe they did some other things. I mean, I know they did some other things, but maybe there's some other visible things too, but that's the
mm-hmm.
only thing I remember, and it got more publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an active group in the Unitarian Church, which is interesting. And the Unitarian Church was always kind of a place where you could meet when other
mm-hmm.
places wouldn't let you meet and all that kind of stuff. And and George Kimbrough, I think, probably got into CORE and that kind of thing because he was a Unitarian. He went to the church, and he was in that group. And that's probably how he got into CORE, and that's probably how we met him. We got to be real good friends. He was our doctor and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When
these groups are forming and stuff, what's your relationship to them, or what are you doing at this time?
Usually helping in the background
status in town?
Well, not only that, with nationally, because,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I remember that Jim Farmer was scared to death that we would get involved in Louisville CORE.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, told wrote letters about it to people here and stuff like that. That's Jim Farmer. I saw him in recent years. He's conveniently forgotten that, I'm sure. But he died. I mean, I saw him some years before he died at something. Mm-hmm. But I never knew him well. Mm-hmm. But he was worried about it. And of course, well, the people who really formed the nucleus of CORE here were pretty good friends of ours, like Tucker and Hewlett and Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
But he was worried it would cause them that bad national publicity if we were involved. So we kind of, I don't think I ever went to a CORE meeting. Mm-hmm. I knew he was active in CORE was Andrew Wade. He went to some of those early meetings. I think it's the last thing that he... I think it's the last thing he did like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what happened that he didn't keep on.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't around, particularly when the big sit-in started. But in those early meetings, he was there. And he was a part of it. I'm pretty sure of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
But so we would just do things in the background. And I guess we probably... Lynn Holt may have come here and looked us up because people knew our name by then. And by that time, of course, we were working with Skeff.
Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't have met him in... anywhere else. I think he was beginning to travel around for CORE, and the best he might remember, I got to write him sometime soon, but mm-hmm. I think he probably just came here and looked us up, because I remember he stayed at our house, cause I mean, being around Beth was a baby. I remember he was there when I was feeding Beth and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she was real little, so it might have been in that summer. She had just been born in February. So it was probably that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think probably, I don't know how this would have happened, that we put him in touch with Purdue and Hewlett and the people that we knew and that we could work with.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the nucleus of a CORE chapter started
mm-hmm.
here and began, and I think maybe had some training sessions for sit-ins or something like that,
mm-hmm.
which he had sort of learned to do. He was a lawyer, but he was much more of a direct action person. He believed in using the courts for action kind of
mm-hmm.
things. And he would teach people how to file their own lawsuits and all stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he had real confrontations in Virginia with what was the equivalent of the Virginia Un-American Activities Committee. They called it something else, but
mm-hmm.
raided their offices and took all their files and stuff. So he'd had a lot of battles. But anyway, that's I think, how the little CORE chapter started. And of course, really generated, they were the ones, although Raoul said it was the NAACP, and I guess the NAACP people were with them, that were doing the sit-ins for almost a year, no, not quite, but for months
mm-hmm.
before the thing exploded were foolish enough to arrest somebody, basically
mm-hmm.
is what happened. And the next day there were more, and the next day there were more, and the next day there were more.
Right.
It was a real mass
That's
movement.
Through the spring
but it was the it was that little group that started it. It was the CORE group. And yeah, we just would help in the background because
mm-hmm.
we didn't, and even there was still, I remember, there was a lot of, you know, the red baiting was still a major thing because
mm-hmm.
it continued a long time after that too. But then, and there was a lot, there was some red baiting of the, of the sit-ins when they started. Because I remember Sterling Neal being by our house. He'd come by every once in a while because he lived right near there. And, of course, Beverly by that time was sort of a leader of it.
Mm-hmm.
And something, we said something about they were accusing him of being communist again. He said, yeah, but I don't think that's going to go this time. And it didn't, you know, it didn't really have that much effect on that movement.
Hmm.
But, So,
the demonstrations themselves were mostly young people, though, right?
Yeah.
Adults?
Oh, yeah. Yes. By the time it got to mass proportions,
yeah.
When they were doing the little ones down there, all that those months, when they go down every Saturday, I think,
mm-hmm.
and it was both. And I was trying to remember that, you know, whether it was I remembered it as being Kaufman's, which was the department store that's long closed up there, north of Muhammad Ali, north of Walnut,
mm-hmm.
And yet I'd see where it was Stewart's, but they were demonstrating both places. The day they got arrested the first time was Stewart's
right,
at the
right.
tea room.
Yeah.
But and that was every Saturday. And that was kind of mixed in ages because I think, you know, Tucker would go.
Mm-hmm.
I think George Kimbrough went. He wasn't real old then, but
mm-hmm.
he was he's more my age, but
mm-hmm.
he was not any student, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And KD was
mm-hmm.
younger. I mean older. So it was a mixture. But then when they arrested the people, and the next day twice as many people came, and then it just sort of quadrupled, and that was really Central High School students is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess some black students from Mayo, and almost and entirely black except for Bertie and Lynn,
that's
few, as
heard.
Far as I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've heard that it's mostly a youth movement and it's mostly black,
mm-hmm.
unlike open housing, which is more mixed in
mm-hmm.
age.
It was mixed in age, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, but the older people did form a committee to support them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was involved in that because those people were didn't want to were afraid of us. And you got to understand, a lot of those people were very friendly to us, but it was just, you stay away and you'll help us by staying away, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they raised money, you know, what they needed for, because they had that free bondsman, Bimbo, got everybody out of jail. But I guess they paid him something, and I suppose they had lawyers. But anyway, they raised money, and then they organized the boycott of downtown, which obviously, and that made a difference then. It wouldn't now because people shop other places,
right.
But it was pretty effective. So the older people came around and supported them.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, and it was pretty good. I think it was pretty solid kind of support, really.
Yeah. And, that's actually the area that I have the best interview stuff on, is people really remember the sit-ins. Other stuff is a little fuzzy, but but those incidents, especially those kids, the people, well, kids, right, they're middle-aged now, but the people who were teenagers at the time,
it's
amazing.
Look back on it as the turning point in their lives.
Yeah,
so probably
it's
a golden moment.
The stories are really crystal clear and really also so uniform that they must be accurate, because everybody remembers the same,
things.
So, one thing that I really want to ask you about, and it kind of starts in the early 60s but goes on, is the West End Community Council.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something that just, when I read about them, it just really interested me.
Yeah, I spent
a
lot of time on that.
But
I don't remember exactly what year it started.
63 or 4 is what I have.
Well, I thought it was a little earlier than that. But
It could be, because, you know, the papers sort of pick up and it's already there, so... Remember
how
that started?
I started it.
Okay, tell me.
But I don't remember what year, and I know I was trying to remember when that guy did that story about me at the time of my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know whether you ever saw it last year? We had a big story in the paper.
I thought I saw it at the time, and I could easily go back and find it.
But he wanted to get that date. He was doing sort of a timeline thing, and I said, well, what's his name? He's a nice guy. He's not being a reporter anymore. He's been doing something else at the paper. But anyway, I said, well, nobody's going to remember. I said, just go on and say it was 62 or whatever. He said, well, you don't know. He said, somebody will, and they'll call up. So I remember I called the guy at the Lincoln Foundation. He just retired. Sam Robinson, who was active in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he racked his brain. We figured out when he came to Louisville, because he got active in it right away and tried to remember. We never did establish. I think it was before 63. Well, yes, I know it was, because... let me think a minute. Because, see, Carl was in prison in 60, went to prison in 61 on the Hewitt case.
Mm.
And was in prison until about February or March of 62. I'm trying to remember. Because I think that some of that was going on then. I don't know. You know, I really could rack my brain and relate it to some other things and figure that out. Anyway, it was early 60s. It was very early 60s. And what had happened was that this goes back, of course, to the 50s, to the late 50s. See, that neighbor, the West End, was beginning to change from black to white to black. And like, you know, we've told you, it was always checkerboard. And we had and the blocks around us were. And 45th Street was the dividing line, then it was black up to the Parkway. And very, you know, the doctors and lawyers lived in, black doctors and lawyers lived on Western Parkway. Some of them still do. And then our blocks and on up to Cecil and on up to 36th Street, or the cemetery there, because the expressway wasn't there then. That got built later, split the neighborhood. But they, then was black and all that. But the real estate people began to really push, you know, and did a lot of scare selling, so that it was changing very quickly. And I don't remember exactly what year that started. I could find, well, it was somewhat gradual, but it happened in a few years. In the late 50s, south of Broadway was like a Maginot line. Blacks couldn't live north of Broadway until you got down to 28th Street, which was the dividing line, always had been the dividing line, or 30th, mostly 28th. But south of Broadway, and they were, you know, doing what they always did. They were going and saying, no, this block's going to be mostly black, you better sell your house now, or you won't have any bay and all that. And they were making a killing. And we thought about it a lot at the time. By that time, we were in and out of town some because of SCAF. But, and what could we do about it? And I knew about these movements or organizations in other places that had campaigns to try to keep areas integrated. In fact, I was in pretty close touch with a guy had worked a lot in Washington. I don't know whether he's still living, Marvin Kaplan. He may not be. who later became head of this, what do they call it, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, that coalition there. And I've lost touch with him, and he's not there anymore, and he may have died. But he and his wife had worked real hard on an effort like that in Washington, which I think probably ultimately failed, because most of them did, mm-hmm. in most places I know of. Here, and probably for some of the same reasons, of course, here, this was the only place blacks could go, so every time we could persuade a white to stay, that was another house the blacks couldn't have, so mm-hmm. that was always sort of a contradiction. Well, we weren't really doing anything then in the late 50s, because we couldn't, and I remember vividly seeing what was happening, and like now on our block, changed to all black pretty soon, and I'm trying to, if I could remember what year, the people who moved next door to us, a woman still living there, were the first black family that moved in, and she would remember when she came there, but it was somewhere in the 50, like 57, 58, mm-hmm. 59 in there sometime. And talk about property values, we'd bought our house in the early 50s for us in the bank for, I think, $7,800 or something. And the houses are exactly alike on that whole block. They were built right after the war, same plan, you know, mm-hmm. four-room houses. We added on to ours and made the attic and stuff. And they paid about $11,000 for theirs right next door just a few years later. And things hadn't gone up that much. I mean, you know, so they, wow. People were buying these houses, scaring people, buying the houses and cheap, and then selling them at inflated prices to blacks. What was going on all over. The real estate people were making a killing because they were selling these houses, buying and selling the houses in the West End. Then they were selling houses mostly out in Southwest Jefferson County to the whites, who often older people who had their houses all paid for here, mm. you know, in the West End, who got scared and sold and moved out there, so they have a whole new market to sell to, see. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of ironic, I remember, Finn, that then after a few years later when we had a flood, before the flood wall was extended further out, that all those people had moved out of the West End, we were high and dry behind the flood wall, and they all got flooded down in Southwest Jefferson County. So
it was before the yeah. flood. Yeah.
It may have been. Yeah. Yeah, it was about when it was, because yeah. I remember. Yeah, the water's kind of coming up in our yard. Mm-hmm. That was because the flood wall was there. That was, I remember what they did. They had pumping stations. They turned the pumping stations on backwards or something, and we had some water in the yard, but Oops. We weren't really flooded.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, so I was working, but I knew I couldn't do anything. I mean, you know, you just really can't grasp how mm-hmm. scared people were of us. I remember calling, I wish I remembered who they were, but I called a number of ministers. White ministers. And there were still a lot of white churches in the West End. Of course, eventually all of them moved
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the church I go to stayed, but became a black church mostly, mm-hmm. which I'm glad it stayed. Calling them and just talking to them. I mean, they knew who I was and stuff. And I said, here's what's happening, and I can't do anything about it, but you can. Why don't you call a meeting and see if we can keep this an integrated area, you know? Mm-hmm. Couldn't get a soul to do anything. They said, well, you know, these things are very difficult. It's just hard to talk to people about this. Nobody would do anything. And I must have talked to three or four ministers I know that I thought might be receptive, who seemed like pretty good people. And I wish I remembered who they were, but I'm blocked out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, somewhere along in the very early 60s, whenever it was, and I could figure it out some way, plus I probably got some literature somewhere, they began the same process north of Broadway. So by that time, I was just getting a little, I'm not going to sit here and let this happen this time. Nobody's going to do anything. So I went to see Gladys Carter at the mm-hmm. YWCA. Have you ever met her? She's still around,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
She's very old by now, I guess, but I think she's still living. But she was very young, she wasn't young. She was old then,
mm-hmm.
in a way, but she was certainly a lot older than me, or seemed that way. She was director of the Y. She had a lot of good programs going. Of course, now it's the Center for Women and Children down there at 43rd and Broadway. It's
mm-hmm.
the West End Y. It was the Phyllis Wheatley Y.
Oh, okay.
It was on 6th Street when I first came here, because
mm-hmm.
I can remember meeting Ms. Meeks there. Somebody told me to look her up, and I was trying to get her into the Progressive Party. Then I got to know her real well at Virginia Avenue later. But that was when the Y was on 6th Street, but at some point they moved to the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a nursery school, and my children had gone there summer to children's activities, so I knew her
mm-hmm.
and somewhat. So I went to see her, and I said, look, Ms. Carter, here's what's happening. You can see what's happening. And I said, we ought to do something about it. And she agreed.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, well, let's have a meeting. And we called a meeting there at the Y. I can't remember who all was at the first meeting, but I don't remember it blow by blow.
Mm-hmm.
But we got a nucleus of people who began to come and decided to form the West End Community Council. Whether we did that at the first meeting, I don't know, but and met there at the Y. And, so the purpose of basically of trying to keep the West End integrated and develop, you know, our position was that we wanted to welcome blacks into these new neighborhoods, I mean into additional neighborhoods, and stay and build them together sort of thing. So we, and that's what we did for the first, whenever we started, till about, I guess, well, actually the West End Community Council sparked the open housing movement, basically, mm-hmm. but that came later, which would have been in, what, 67, mm-hmm. or began, I guess, in
66.
Began in 66, mm-hmm. so along in there, mm-hmm. shifted to doing that, and then by that time we'd lost the battle, really, in the mm-hmm. West End, and the West End Community Council became more of an action organization trying to help solve problems in the West End. I'll come back to that later, but for mm-hmm. those years, that's what we were doing, and especially in the early, you know, until maybe 65. And we would go out door to door talking to people, and we had a bunch of people. Dr. Kimbrough was active in it, and trying to think who else that might still be around. I could think of some people, but so it would be, I don't know, we'd have maybe 10, 20, sometimes 25 people at a meeting. And we put out literature, which I may still have. I know it's in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Well, I may still have a... Right, somebody drew us a piece of artwork. It was a little boy sitting down, looking stubborn, and saying, "Well, I'm," and then the head on it says, "Well, I'm not moving." And I remember I wrote it. It's a little four-page folder about what we wanted to do with the West End. Maybe I can find that somewhere. It's probably in stuff. It may. I tell you where it is. It's probably a lot of those early West End Community Council files were given to U of L archives. I didn't send them to Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah. At some point, and I think Father Charles Tackow, who became director of it, and we got to the stage of having staff at one point, I think sent stuff out there, and I think I did too.
Okay.
I think I just decided not to send all that stuff to Wisconsin because it was a lot of local stuff. So it may be there. I may still even have one of those somewhere. I don't know.
Well,
if I come across it,
Fred
I'll get it to
gave
you.
Gave me a box of West End Community Council stuff. I just haven't opened it yet.
Well, Judy got his wife mm-hmm. got very active in it,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't come till 66. She
right,
was active
so
more in the later stages of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether he'd have that early stuff or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a little brochure telling what the community council was, but we had that little "I'm not moving" before it said why we were staying and all that. So we would take that and we'd go out and we wanted to get people to put up signs, which has been done a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
This house is not for sale.
Right.
And we did on some blocks over north of Broadway and some south of Broadway. It was quite, we had a good bit of support over in that little enclave between Western Parkway and the river. It's still a really nice area over there, Riverview and 47th Street.
Yeah.
Well, no, you about to run out of tape?
I just put in a new one.
Oh, I thought you were about to run out.
Nope.
General. Yeah, Norma Shobe was chair at one point, but that was a little later, and she lived down there. And there was a bunch of white people lived in there then. Harvey Webster, he
mm-hmm.
was very active. He taught, he's died after he moved to Texas, but he was a professor at U of L. He lived on 47th Street, him and his wife. They were real nice, and they were active in the community council, and they lived down there. And the Furlongs, well, no, not so much, but they still live there. Tom Furlong, I think, has died, but Ms. Furlong still died. And Laura Furlong was in high school then, and she got active in some of the cultural kind of stuff that we were doing that I'll tell you about in a minute.
Yeah.
The first time I knew her, but she's still living down there. And she's married to this Mexican. They've got this really good...
I eat there all the time. Mine
restaurant.
Gypsy.
Yeah, that's her restaurant, yeah. Well, and she and her husband still live there in an apartment in her mother's house or something. But so there were... But anyway, I'm trying to remember the first, I was never an officer, obviously, I was still staying in the background,
mm-hmm.
but I did a lot of the paperwork, I was all in, it was a woman, I believe was the first co-chair, we always had co-chairs, black and white, there was a white minister, but I don't remember his name, who had the Lutheran, I think it was a Lutheran church over here on River Park, he was a minister, we had several ministers, actually, Tom Moffat when he came here, but that wasn't until 66 got into it, but that was later. But we always had some ministers, white mm-hmm. as well as black. And there was this white minister who was the first co-chair. Then there was a guy named Ken Phillips for a while. He moved away, but he was chair for a while. Then Norma Shobe at one point was chair, or co-chair, and she got real active, gave a lot of time to it. And Oh, and Sam Robinson was chair for a while. Mm-hmm. He joined at one. And he told me when I ran into him at this one Louisville thing up at Spalding, mm-hmm. after they threw us out, and we mm-hmm. went back that day, and we were talking afterwards. Some way we got talking about the Western Community Council. And he was saying that a lot of people ask him, why are you associating with people like the Bradens and stuff when he first came here? But he lived down here on 44th Street, mm-hmm. and he got very active in it, and then he went on to other things. But anyway, that's the main thing we were doing in the beginning. And I think we certainly didn't stop the white flight north of Broadway. I think we slowed it in some places. But we got a lot of that propaganda out and got a lot of people involved. And then the Catholic Sisters got involved in it. And that was, they had that convent at 45th and Broadway. You've probably read about the big mansion. It's now a gospel church or something, where they just had a big meeting on the faith-based ministries thing. And they came. I'll never forget the first night they walked into the Y and just sat down at the meeting. They were still wearing their habits. And I had never known any Catholic nuns in my life because I was, there weren't many in Alabama where I grew up. There weren't many Catholics, and there weren't any nuns in my town. We had a little Catholic church. One of my friends was Catholic, but I'd never known any Catholic nuns. But they were wonderful. And they got so active, and they would go out with us door to door. They were all white. Mm-hmm. But they... And I got to be real good friends with several of them. And then while all this was going on, while the community council was still viable, they came out of their habits, you see, mm-hmm. and had this great revolution, changed their names, some of them, and everything, mm-hmm. which I regret it in some ways. And I remember I took, because then by that time, we were going to City Hall about different things. I'll come to it in a minute. And I said, y'all look like everybody else. It was impressive when we could take you down there looking like nuns, But there was this, she's still here. I've had some disagreements with her lately. Rose Colley, who runs Just Solutions. Did she tell you anything about the West End Community Council?
She remembered a little bit, not very much.
Really? Well, she's done so many things since. Yeah. But did she tell you about her, about...
Standing up for you?
Yeah, did she tell you about that? Yeah. She may remember that because I've told the story in recent years. She may not have remembered that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When that was after... And she was, her name was Sister John Martin mm-hmm. when she was in her habit, and then she changed to Rose Colley. I think this all happened maybe while she was still Sister John Martin. But you see, that was after we began to get poverty money. We were probably the first group in Louisville that got some poverty money. Mm-hmm. Because when the poverty program was passed in Congress, which would have been, about 65, I think. Mm-hmm. Or it could have been 64. Civil Rights Act was 64. The Voting Rights Act was 65. I think poverty, maybe 64.
I think it actually passed in 64, but kind of got up and running in 65.
And there was a guy, I can't remember his name, that was sort of trying to get it started here, and he had some connection with the university, and he would come to see us. And we were about the only organized thing in the West End, really. Mm-hmm. So we were natural to get some of it, and we applied for it, and we actually got it, and had enough money to hire a few people to do some things. I tell you who else was active some was Ruth Bryant, who was later one of the Black Six and all that. She had been active in a lot of things, civil rights stuff. And all through that period, that's also when the whole Allied Organization for Civil Rights was going on. They were organizing the big march in Frankfort, which we weren't involved in at all. Frank Stanley Jr. was in, and he was scared to death of us, And they didn't know what to do about us. But anyway, we were busy with other things anyhow. But Ruth was active in that, but she was in the West End Community Council too, somewhat. But anyway, and Bob Douglas, who's now, he was one of the first people that the community council hired. He was supposed to be an organizer. I don't think Bob ever did much of it. I don't think Bob was really an artist. He was really an artist and scholar. You know how he is. And I'm trying to think who else at that point. But anyway, we had this money, and we hadn't any money. We were just a volunteer organization, didn't need any, except we'd collect enough money to put out. And we had a little newsletter, which I did, mm-hmm. on a mimeograph machine, on a typewriter and a mimeograph machine. That's mm-hmm. how you did them in those days. And I put that together, and we got it out, I think, every month. I don't know. We met pretty regularly. And I guess it was after we got involved in the poverty program, and we didn't really have many contacts out in the housing projects, the things they've just now torn down at Park mm-hmm. Duval. Mm-hmm. But one night, Well, the thing about, I don't know what, I've never told you that story, but she did, about when they were had met till midnight trying to decide whether I should resign from the community council. Yeah. And took up a lot of time and everybody. It was really literally midnight, and she had just, and see, these were all my friends too, because well, they couldn't exactly say I'd infiltrated the community council since I'd organized, and everybody knew that, and knew that I did a lot of the work. Not most. We had people really worked hard, but I did the paperwork, which is, you know, does help hold an organization together, and I was doing all the door-to-door stuff too. But, and that didn't, and so they were all my good friends, so it was, well, should they do that to keep the poverty money? Because it was whoever was in Congress then, it was probably Gene Snyder, was raising hell, you know, about this poverty money because of me and that kind of thing. And I can't remember in what form, but it was going on that he was raising the hell. But anyway, she, you know, she just sat there quiet all night, and then she finally said, well, that she just sat and listened, and she thought there were other things we ought to be talking about, but that, that if you can put Ann Braden out for being a communist, you can put me out for being a Catholic, so if she leaves, I'm leaving too. That's what she said. And everybody just shut up. It never came up again. Never came up again in the West End Community Council. And we kept the poverty money. I mean, they just fought about it. We kept it, so it shows you didn't have to give in to that sort of thing. I think she probably would have forgotten that, but when the Loretta sisters gave me their award one year, they'd give an award, their Mary Rhodes Award or something. It was the first award I ever got. It was before other people began giving me awards. It was back in the 80s, and it was, they had the ceremony down at Loretta, and I went down, Dolores Delahanty, I think Dolores was getting one at the same time. I mean, we rode down together, and I told that about her there, so I think, and I told it other places, so that's why she remembers it now, but it was important in my life. It was really pretty courageous of her, and I like her a lot, and I've run into her through the years. I'm not pleased with some of the things she's doing right now, just solutions with the police thing, but I'm not directly involved in that. She's a great person. But anyway, there were others, and they were all very active. But then when after we got the poverty money, and I guess we began trying to make some contacts in the project areas or something, but I'll never forget the day, the night that some of these people from the project, one of them was named Rose Calvin. I think she's died. I'm not sure. There were some others. Has she died? Yeah. And there was another woman who became quite a leader here later. It was just a woman living in the project then, and I keep forgetting her name, but it'll come to me. And anyway, it was a bunch of women came wanting our help because they were, had so many problems at, in the Cotter homes and Lang homes, which was right across the street, across 34th Street. And nobody would pay them any attention. And that people, if you went down to City Hall or you called or anything, they treated you like dirt because you lived in a project. And I remember Rose Calvin because she became quite a leader, but I remember she was really crying that night when she was talking about it. So we got very involved. This was a departure from what we were doing, you know, in supporting them. And they organized some sort of a neighborhood association, I forget what it was called, and became very vocal, and they were at City Hall half the time, and we would support them, you see. That's when we were... But then the sisters were out of their habits on things. And they really began to get attention. And I think, and really ultimately got that health clinic, among other things, you know. And the and then some of them got jobs with the poverty program. And I think, you know, the poverty program had all kinds of, it's been much too maligned by the right wingers, because it did give some people a start. From our point of view then, and we were also, SCEF was dealing with it in Appalachia too. And it was also a system of controlling people. In a lot of places, the money went to the what Al McShirley used to call the courthouse gangs, and it really didn't help the people much, which was true. It became a racket in some ways. But I think about that neighborhood, it really did give some people a chance to develop some organizing skills and give them some confidence, give them a framework to work in, and gave a few people jobs to do it. And they had an effect in a place like Park Duval, no doubt about it. That's when that neighborhood began to organize. And so the West End Community Council kind of played a supporting role. And gradually, because we had lost the battle, really, we never sat down and had a postmortem and say, well, we're really not going to keep the West End integrated. We never said that. It did just become pretty evident. And we had been advocating for an open housing ordinance from the very beginning, maybe in that first brochure, probably was. But by that time... we'd gotten also, in addition to the poverty money, we got, I remember, a fairly substantial grant, maybe like $10,000, which doesn't sound like a lot then, but it's a lot to us, then from the Episcopal Church. Because, see, the churches nationally, this was the National Episcopal Church, were given money to community things in the ferment of the 60s developed a conscience or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And it became more accentuated later after the urban, we called them uprisings, they
right.
called them riots. Later in the 60s, they began pouring all kinds of money in. But even then, they were beginning to do that. And, you know, Jim Foreman, you probably know about that, was had that whole challenge to the, what do they call it, the Black Manifesto, to the churches, which really shook a lot of money loose. He
mm-hmm.
never got any of it. Other mm-hmm. people got it. It was really ironic.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to his 70th birthday party they had in Washington last year, and they, this woman who's now with the, well, in the Commission for Racial Justice that Ben Chavis used to do at the United Church was talking about how she remembers Ben then. And that's, I mean, Jim then. That's the way she likes to remember him. He's gotten very mild and sort of mellowed with age now, and he was very fiery then. But how he never got any of that money, but other people got it.
Mm-hmm.
And the churches were. So they were already doing some of that. And so we got a grant from the Episcopal Church, and we had enough to hire somebody. Oh, and I remember the woman who was chair then. I've often wondered what happened to her. She was a wonderful woman. She was a white woman. She was Catholic. We had a lot of Catholics because there was so much Catholic strength in
mm-hmm.
here. Oh, and she had 10 children. I mean, she always talked about that. She had 10, but she would come around some way. She found time to do all this work as a volunteer. Because, I mean, when we got that first grant, she was so pleased. Now she said, well, you know, she was trying to keep this thing going. Now we were going to have a little money to hire somebody. So we hired Holbert, who had come here from New York and had a wonderful wife who was, I thought, but she never was that active. She was a very talented actress. And she did some things at Actors Theater, which was in its earlier years. Then she played the lead role in White America. You know that
I've heard of it actually. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a one woman thing. I think this. She played a major role in it. She was a very talented actress. But anyway, and I don't even know where we met him, but he was around. And I can't even tell you the truth. I'm not sure how he got to Louisville, but he was from New York. I'm pretty
mm-hmm.
sure. And so he became the director when we had a little money. And he, and I think Holbert, as much as anything, talked to these other groups. By that time, we had A.D. King was here, you
mm-hmm.
see, at Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And the NAACP, I forget who was head of then.
Hodge.
Anyway, Hodge. Mm-hmm. So Holbert was really the spark plug on getting them together to work together on the open housing issue, which led to the open housing movement, or there was a sort of a steering committee,
mm-hmm.
which I never went to any of those things either.
Oh, you didn't?
I didn't go to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the demonstrations.
Okay.
Carl never did.
Mm-hmm.
Holbert talked about that because I was a little bit seen as a little bit less dangerous than Carl, which was probably a sexist thing.
Right. Yeah.
But and by that time, the SCEF office, the open housing demonstrations, had moved here next door, so our that house was becoming a center of a lot of activity.
Mm-hmm.
One reason we got this building is to catch the overflow. But Holbert, I remember at the memorial service they had in New York for Carl Holbert was one of the people who spoke. And somebody had talked to from the South, Jessica Simpkins, I guess, about how Carl and Ann Brayton, which is sort of inseparable. You always thought of them together. And when Holbert says, in Louisville, they weren't inseparable. And he can remember how I'd be out marching with them, but Carl would be there running the leaflets up until 7 o'clock so we'd have them to take
mm-hmm.
with us or run them on the printing press, but he didn't go
mm-hmm.
because it would cause too much trouble for the movement and stuff like that. And so I never went to any of the meetings, I don't think, of the steering committee or whatever it was, the open housing movement. But SCEF supported it, you know. I mean, we were just a little bit on the fringes like we were on everything, but doing a lot of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And the West End Community Council was the office. By that time, the West End Community Council had a little office down in the building, I guess because Vernon Robertson had appeared on the scene. You know who he was. Did you ever interview him before he died?
No. He died before I started working on this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was an interesting guy. He had come, he was a Catholic priest, but he had been in the Episcopal Church before. In
mm-hmm.
fact, he had a part in reviving St. George's that I go to
mm-hmm.
after they decided to stay in the West End. But he became a Catholic priest, and he was a wonderful guy. He was a man. I liked him. I lost touch with him in those last years, and I should have kept in touch. But he was very conservative theologically.
Mm-hmm.
But he was pretty radical in his politics and everything. And he wasn't scared to associate with us, which is determined what we could do in those days. But to me, looking back on it, it's kind of a litmus test now. I can tell you whether people have any courage or not, you know. But he bought this house down at 44th and Broadway. It's not on the corner. It's next to the corner there. And moved there. He supported the West End Community Council. I can't remember whether he really came to the meetings, but he was very supportive. He had money, for one thing. but he wasn't just giving us money. He was supportive in a lot of ways, and he wanted to get more white people into the West End, so he bought this house. And he would have gatherings there. He tried to get sort of discussion groups going every Sunday night. I went some, but, you know, people didn't keep going. But it was nice when he had, and he'd have good food. And he'd been told, oh, and he finally sold the house just not too many years before he died. And he died just a few years ago. I guess it's been more years than I think. But it hadn't been many years, Tracy. I'm surprised it was before you started on this. But anyway, he had come, and he had, and actually he didn't live there for some of those years. He let other people live there. And there was a guy named Tony Hassan, who's still around. And I've got to get in touch with Tony, because he was one of the people who was very frightened of me in the West End Community Council. And he's been so contrite in recent years, and I get, you know, tired of hearing these people explain about all their that sort of thing. But he got active in FOR a few years ago, and he came around here. And, in fact, I encouraged him to get active in the Alliance, and he came to one or two meetings. He lives out somewhere in Shively. I think he's in the phone book. It's either Anthony or Tony Hassan, H-A-S-S-O-N. But somewhere I've heard that he's maybe had some kind of a breakdown or something, or he's not active anymore. I don't know, but he was a very intense guy, and he got very interested in the Park Duval thing. He was sort of a missionary spirit. He wanted to work there and do things, but he was scared of me, and he... And, oh, I'll tell you who was active in the Western Community Council, who was scared, that although we were always friendly on the surface, was Norbert Logsdon and his wife, who they still live in the West End. Mm-hmm. And surprising how many white people still live in the West End, really, sometimes. And I ran into him walking around the track, where I just walk every day when I can, and we talked. But it's only, and she's the one, she's been doing a lot trying to... bring blacks and whites together. So she's active in Christ the King Church, and it was written up in the paper a lot last year.
Yeah, I remember seeing
it. She got the woman who left down there, Rochelle Riley, and she got to be friends, and she wrote up this thing she was doing there. And I went down to one of their things, but they had several of them. And it was kind of, and made quite a story, because she tells about how she jumped on little Kevin Cosby when he was little. He pulled up her flowers or something like that. He lived down there. So they're still there. But he told me, and I don't know whether he told me or maybe Tony Hassan told me, that actually somebody in the Catholic Church told them to join the West End Community Council, really to keep an eye on me and what I was doing.
Really?
Because I was an evil influence or something. I don't know. But they actually got active and did some work, so it didn't matter. So he lived at Fontaine House, Vernon called this house. Fontaine House. And it's the second house from the corner beyond 44th Street as you go down from here on the right, kind of across the street from the convent, right before you get to the convent.
Mm-hmm.
Big house, beautiful house. And he lived there, and he kind of opened it up. That's where, so we began to meet there some. And instead of at the Y, we'd still meet at the Y some, but we met there some. He lived there a year, and it was kind of an open place where you could have meetings. Then he left to go live somewhere else, and the guy, Joe Wise, who's a folk singer, he and his wife, I think he studied for the priesthood and she was a nun, and they left and got married or something. But and they moved in there, and they were great musicians and did a lot of stuff for us, and every once in a while I read something about him. He still does kind of religious
the
folk music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was different then, because they had just gotten married. They didn't want a lot of people around and stuff, so it became less that way. Then finally, it was after that, Vernon moved back in, or maybe he hadn't really lived there before. He moved in and really lived there, and he would have people over and that kind of thing. But he also bought a house, or not a house, a building down here at 37th and Broadway, which is still there. In fact, I think the Nation of Islam is using it as an office now, I believe. But he bought that building with the idea of developing a coffee house. Those big things was coffee houses. And we had the coffee house movement, which, of course, was a big thing here, too, you know, for the Army with Fort Knox. That was another thing, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of support here for the anti-war movement in the Army. And they all hung out all over here at this. We printed their paper, you know, on our printing press. FTA, Food, Travel, and Adventure, it really meant fuck the Army, and they were around and stuff. And we were all leaving and deserting and going to Canada and all that.
Who? Somebody else told me about that.
Mm-hmm. But that was a little later in the 60s. But but he wanted to have a coffee house and kind of a cultural center. And they did for a while. They would have things on Friday and Saturday nights. I think it never worked out too well. I think the kind of culture that he was thinking about in the folk music wasn't what really appealed to the young blacks in the West End and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So it didn't quite work out. And I think he got real disappointed about that, but he still owned the building. And then, so for a while, the West End Community Council sort of had an office there. Mm-hmm. I think Hulbert was working out of there. And then later it became Four Quarters, which was sort of a black cultural thing. Ron Long, who worked, was a really talented reporter that really, the Defender had a lot of life when he was writing for it. He's now in Arizona or somewhere. Ran this thing called Four Quarters. It was kind of a cultural and action thing in the black community, and Vernon may have still owned it then. But Vernon eventually, he stayed there a long time at Fontaine House, but he finally left the West End before he died. Mm-hmm. But I think he was always, in fact, you know, it hit that when he died, he was a good friend of Pat Delahanty's, mm-hmm. and they had his funeral and everything. Not his funeral, I guess that was at the church, but the wake and all that at A.D. Porter Funeral Home mm-hmm. over, and everybody in the world was there, sort of, at 13th and Chestnut. But Pat said that one of Vernon's great desires was that he wanted to be buried by A.D. Porter, because he said if he couldn't get white people to come to the West End while he was alive, he'd get them after he's dead. They'd come to his wake, and mm-hmm. they did. Mm-hmm. So, but that was one of his passions. Mm-hmm. And anyway, but Hulbert, going back to him in the West End community, I think was working out of that building that he bought at 37th Street for a while. But he really changed the West End Community Council correctly, I mean, I think, imperceptibly. And as I say, nobody sat down and said, well, okay, we failed to integrate, let's do something else. It just happened because he worked with these other people to spark the open housing movement mm-hmm. because obviously we really, it was a built-in contradiction as long right. as the only place blacks could go and that was the answer and all that. So that fit in. But Hulbert also turned it into an action organization to try to deal with the many problems in the West End, which were being terribly neglected, because one thing that was happening is there were fewer whites in the West End. It was getting much less attention from mm-hmm. City Hall, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, neighborhoods, the streets weren't being cleaned properly. And, I mean, that was one of the main issues out in Park Duval, was they didn't even pick up the trash. I mean, we took pictures. I was sort of a photographer then. I didn't keep it up, but I went and took a lot of pictures down there. These trash just sitting there for weeks. Mm-hmm. I know Ruth Bryant took them and showed them to some public hearing she was going to. Mm-hmm. And it was just things like that. They weren't getting city services. So Hulbert was a real organizer, and he really worked with the people there and helped them organize, but he also organized the Welfare Rights Organization here and a tenant association. The only time we've had an independent tenant association here, we've got the tenants union. Mm-hmm. And they were organizing in Park and Cotter Homes and Lang Homes and branching out to some other places too. Now we have the Tenant Association. I've had good friends work there, but it's a service organization. Mm-hmm. These were tenant organizations, and the welfare rights people, like here, like everywhere, were very militant, and some of them are still around. They've mm-hmm. you know, faded into the scenery too, but they went and occupied the welfare offices and all kinds of stuff here. I don't remember everything, but. But they, you know, demanding their rights. It's interesting as you look back on it, because I think, like, when this whole transition, welfare to work and the welfare reform, and people were objecting to that, which I think was a bad thing. I think some things have come out of it, but some people have really been hurt. Mm-hmm. I think Kentucky's done better than some places, really. Mm-hmm. And I know some things have happened in Mississippi. But it was just the whole thing was so phony anyway, because, I mean, Clinton really, you know, took up the Reagan mm-hmm. cry to end welfare, mm-hmm. you know, which was a 1% of our budget, and the whole mythology that built up about the welfare mothers, which I think Clinton was bought into to mm-hmm. for political expediency. But people wondered, you know, why, or felt like, you know, the welfare mothers themselves ought to be rising up and protesting this, and there wasn't much of that here, and I don't think in many places. There are a few mm-hmm. places where there are welfare rights organizations. And it's really kind of sad, because when I look back at those, the welfare rights organization as was here, and it wasn't near as big and powerful here as in some places, that there was a spirit there that I think has gradually been destroyed by people that bought into blaming themselves for their problems. Mm-hmm. Because those women didn't have any doubt that they had rights to live, and mm-hmm. that they were within their rights when they went and demanded that they get the proper benefits, you know, mm-hmm. to raise their children mm-hmm. and stuff, and they just believed that. And I think a lot of people who've had to struggle now have bought the myth that it's their fault.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad. Now, maybe the people get out of it once, you know, somebody gives them a different idea,
mm-hmm.
and they show how the system really works. But anyway, I hope it started that. And the West End Community Council, by that time, I was traveling a lot more for SCAP, and I was not really active in it in those last years. Now, Judy Hicks began to do the newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and did a good job on it, too. And she'd do it. She'd put it together. We had a typesetter and stuff, or eventually we had a typesetter at SCAF, and she would do it there, and she put that out. And it continued for several years, and then after Hobart was basically run out of town, I think.
Right.
Because
I read the articles about that.
Well, where I didn't know it was in print anywhere.
In the Courier Journal, there was an article about him being accused of, contributing to delinquency of a minor or something
that. Yeah, it was an article in the Courier Journal, wasn't
it? Yeah, because that's the only way. I haven't read The Defender up that far, so it must have been the Courier.
Hmm.
One of my students interviewed him, but I haven't heard the interview yet.
Well, I don't know what he says now, but there's no doubt that there was. He was, he and his wife finally separated because he was having sort of an affair with this Randy Bledsoe, she's a beautiful young woman, I don't know, and there were a couple of Bledsoe girls. Tom Bledsoe had come here, he's died. I knew him in another connection before that. But they were very active in that student sort of thing. And I don't know the 61 sit-ins. It may have been after that, maybe in open housing, possibly. There were a lot of young people in that, white and black, so that's probably where they were active. Yeah, and the picture I have of them in a demonstration somewhere, I think, was maybe during some demonstrations around the Black Six. So, but anyway, she was only about 15, but she seemed older. But anyway, he was having some kind of an affair with her or something, and and her mother got hysterical or something, and so did other people. It was people who should have known better, and they pretty much, I think, as I recall, I can't remember exactly, that they just kind of dropped the charges if he'd leave town. Well, they wanted to get rid of him. You know, Louisville's good at running people out. They'd have run us out except we had some way to pay the grocery bill from SCAF. I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I wished I'd kept records down through the years of people who have been run out of town. Because I guess every town does that, but it seems to me Louisville's been pretty skillful at it, but he was run out of town. And eventually, well, I think Charles Tackow, I guess he actually worked as... did you ever interview him?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, my memory may not be right on it, but I think he actually worked on the staff of the West End Community Council, too. He became director after Hobart, I guess, is what happened. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped get... he was...
oh yeah, I get that sense.
But he helped that the bulk Black Unity League of Kentucky get going, and that was some of the key people in that were some of them were people who had come here for SCLC, who sent a bunch of young staff people in around the open housing thing, and some of them stayed. One of them was Bob Kuyu by then, but his name originally was Bob something else.
Sims,
yeah. Well, that's the way he came, and he was one of the founders of Bulk, and there was a little group of them, and that was the group that called the demonstration out at 28th and Greenwood, where there was the explosion and stuff over Manfred Reed's arrest. But Charles was involved in all that, and he was pastor then at St. George's, and I never will forget the speech he made at when things like we've jumped around, so we're way to the late 60s now. There were a lot of white people trying to be active by then. And when the Black Six happened, we put together some kind of a ad hoc committee that involved a lot of white people meeting out in white churches in the East End and stuff. But I remember Charles, and we printed it. I've got it somewhere. Charles made this speech about the Black Six case. You know, they were charged with trying to... or conspiring to blow up the oil refineries, which was crazy. They wouldn't have done that because it would have destroyed the West End, basically, you know. But they didn't blow up. And, of course, now they're gone anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they were an eyesore for years, but they were operating then. And I remember he got up and talked about the case, and he said it didn't matter whether these people were guilty or not. That's what he said. Which I got to remind him of that someday. Because that was at the time of the Kerner Report, and people were focusing a lot more than they do today, to tell you the truth, on the fact that whatever's wrong is racism, that's what's causing these things. And that was in the air, and people were picking it up. But so eventually, and I really don't know exactly when the demise of the West End Community Council came, whether it just sort of faded away or whether they ever met and say, well, we'll just, you know, this has served its purpose and we'll disband. I don't know.
Were you not as active after a while? Because you said you were doing a lot of sketch stuff.
Mm-hmm. And by that time, well, I'd see Hulbert a lot, and we'd do, but I was away a lot. You know, I was in and out of town, and there were a lot of other people active, and I just wasn't that needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd done a lot of the paperwork and done the newsletter. Judy started doing the newsletter and leaflets, and, you know, I was good at that kind of thing, but we had other people to do it. And I can't even remember going to the meetings a lot in those last years of the later 60s, after, say, about 67, after the open housing movement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although it was quite active for 2 or 3 years after that, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I have it through at least 69.
That's about right.
There's a big meeting in 69.
Of the council.
But then it seems to go pretty quickly after that.
Mm-hmm.
Big article in the Courier Journal, even, like half page, covering this meeting they had in, like, September of 69.
What was it about? Do you remember?
Oh, about whether or not WEC was a Black Power organization.
Well, I remember there was, I wasn't there when all that debate was going on, which I think was kind of unnecessary in that organization, really. I don't know how it got started.
Mm-hmm.
But it was maybe an important question. I don't quite know how it fit in there. It may have. That's interesting. I'd like to see that article, because Western Community Council never had a lot of publicity in the paper, to tell you the truth. I think it was a lot more important than the paper, just looking at the paper, would reflect. See, one thing I meant to tell you, we did at least 2 summers, maybe 3, we had a festival in Shawnee Park.
And there is some articles about the festival.
Are there articles about that?
From one year.
Yeah, we worked real hard on that, and I did the book. We did nice little booklets. I think I still have those booklets. Have you seen the little booklets we did?
Mm-hmm.
We'd put out booklets, and we were trying to build a community spirit, and that was when the West End was still pretty mixed. And we would have art displays, people come and show their art, and we had crafts and all that kind of stuff, things for the kids. And we had Shakespeare in the Park would come down. Doug Ramey, who's director of Shakespeare in the Park at Central Park, I think 2 years, maybe more than two. I don't know whether we did it 2 years or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think about three. He came and put on a play, a Shakespeare play for us. That's where I met Laura Furlong, because she was a had a dance show or something, and she was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a student at Loretta High School, which was still going. So they were big events. A lot of people came.
Yeah, I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions about things that came up. I read about some vistas that worked for the West End Community Council.
That's right. We got vistas for a while, and some of those people stayed and became a part of Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
One guy started the, what was his name? He's still around, I think, although he's started the, some sort of a West End theater group.
Carol Shemp?
Yeah, Carol Shemp. Is he still around?
Yeah. He's a real estate agent now.
Is he? Yeah, but he was doing that theater for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then the other thing, Dolores White started this thing. Now, she worked with the council. She started the Pigeon Roost Theater down at the Y, up in Pigeon Roost, up in the top floor of the Y, and put on plays, really good plays. She's very talented. She's still around. She actually directed the St. George Community Center for a while. Had a lot of tragedy in life. She lost 2 sons. One of them was killed in an industrial accident, and another one in some drug shooting or something.
Mm.
But she has a daughter who's named Portia. She named her Portia because her love of the theater or something.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been in the theater some, worked at Actors Theater, and she's married to that, I guess she still is, that guy that's always attacking Reverend Cosby. Kind of crazy. I haven't seen him lately, thank goodness. But Dolores developed some. There was a guy named, and he came by here recently. I hadn't seen him in years. Redding. What was his first name? He was a good actor, but he's gone into something else. And she kind of developed him. And he was sort of a genius. I knew his mother. He went to Virginia Avenue. She was in the PTA, and she was a very poor woman, and she had several children who were really geniuses. And she. And so he had, and he went on to, he's got some kind of career now. He lives out in the East End, I think, took his address. But anyway, there was, you know, it's interesting. You keep remembering things, because there was so much ferment in the 60s, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it produced all these other things as sort of spinoffs in a way. One woman who came here as a Vista, later, I think she came as a Vista. What was her name? She then went to work for the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights and really did the basic work on that first history book they put out.
Really?
Because I worked with her on it and helped her. And influence some of the things they said in it, I think. But also loaned them some pictures, most of which I never got back. I've been trying to get those pictures back. I asked John Johnson about them once, and I think I got a few back. But and that book, they've been talking about redoing it, but I don't think that's happened yet.
You mean the paperback book?
But it's a book this size, like notebook, but like...
Okay, I've seen it.
It's for use in high schools,
right,
basically.
Right, aimed at sort of a younger...
Yeah, audience. History of Blacks in Kentucky or
right.
something like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Well, I think she did a lot of the work on that, and I can't think of her name, but she came here as a Vista.
Okay.
So people branched out into other things, mm-hmm. but it was...
The other group of people that I wanted to ask about was people who came here to work with Prescott.
Mm-hmm.
I know that SCAP was involved with the McShirley stuff out in did SCAP play much role in Louisville itself?
Well, it began to. It moved here. It wasn't when, of course, the office was in New Orleans when we went to work on the staff of SCAP, which
mm-hmm.
was 57.
Mm-hmm.
And then it moved here in 66, in January of 66, okay. I remember it very well, and the reason being that Jim Dombrowski, who had been director, retired,
mm-hmm.
and the board decided they wanted us to be directors, and we didn't want to leave Louisville because there were too many people trying to run us out.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was just mm-hmm. overtly what it was about. So they said it didn't matter where the office was, we could move it here because it was regional anyway. So we did and decided to, and somebody gave us enough money to buy that house next door because we figured we'd be evicted any place we rented. And I don't know really how we found that. Maybe Dorcas Ruthenberg, have you run into her?
She passed away, I heard.
Oh, I know, but if you run into
her name. Oh, the name, yeah, the name comes up all the time, yeah.
Well, she was, did work for WHAS, did the Morrill side of the
mm-hmm.
news, and was kind of prominent in town. But some way we got to be friends. Actually, we got to be friends early. She and another woman that I've lost touch with who may have died, too. We used to have lunch together a lot at the airport because it was the only place we could all eat. The other woman was black.
Mm-hmm.
She was active in Coke Methodist Church, what is her name. But anyway, we would go out there and meet for lunch. So I'd known Dorcas. Must have been into the 50s, back in the 50s sometime. I can't remember how we got to be friends, but we got to be real good friends. And we would have lunch out there with us once a month or something. But we got her involved in SCAF, partly because we needed some respectability. She became treasurer of SCAF. We needed, here because we were such... I mean, in the first place, we were pariahs, and then SCAF was not very respectable itself. Anybody knew anything about it. And it was just... So... and she got us a real good, and he became a good friend of ours, Earl Fowler, an accountant that she knew at the Unitarian Church to take care of our books and, that kind of thing. So later, George Edwards became treasurer.
Oh.
And I used to have arguments with him about black power. He never could see black power.
Mm-hmm.
She was very interested in housing. Open housing was her big thing. I don't think she was active in the demonstrations. But she went to whatever kind of training you go to become a real estate agent, basically to find housing for blacks in white neighborhoods, sort
mm-hmm.
of to integrate housing. So she knew real estate, and I know she found that she did the deal on this house for us, but I believe she found that house was how it happened to be that we just got it. It wasn't
mm-hmm.
any particularly to say it just seemed like a good buy, and we got it at the time we bought it next door. People were living in it and had apartments upstairs and stuff and stayed for a few months, and finally we expanded to the whole building. And then it was an office. And some of the young staff people of SCAF, because SCAF staff was sort of expanding with people working for subsistence,
mm-hmm.
and living there and stuff. And they lived upstairs, some of them, and that kind of thing. But we finally needed the whole building for offices, and we just were growing. And by that time, it was becoming a center of local movement activity
okay.
for young people. Because, you had a whole generation that wasn't scared of us. In fact, it came around, figured if we were under attack, we must have done something good. So really, we're attracted.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a real kind of center. And people like Hulbert, who never, and stuff, and even with... as the 60s went on, there were I don't know, it was just different. There was just another generation here, and
mm-hmm.
they were frequenting that house all the time, which
mm-hmm.
is one reason we got this house, because this house sat empty. A woman lived here, died,
and sat empty for a year, and Carl was watching the house all year. He said, I bet we'll get that house real cheap sometime, and sure enough we did, for about $7,000 that this couple gave us. Mm-hmm. And fortunately gave it to, we're kind of old and cranky and wanted to give it to Carl and me, so the house was bought in our name, and we leased it to Skeff for $1 a year. So when Skeff broke up and this mm-hmm. took over Skeff, they couldn't get this building. That's why we have it today.
Mm-hmm.
But and so there were a lot of people coming in there, including, as I say, all these people from the GI movement. And they, of mm-hmm. course, had the coffee house in Muldraw, which was a big battle down there about mm-hmm. that. But and by that time, the anti-war movement had gotten so big here. You know, that started, George and Jean were a big part of, not Jean so much. Jean became more active later as their children were grown, mm-hmm. but it was George. And I think starting about 65 or 66, maybe, every Wednesday, some of us would go down to Guthrie Green and vigil. And then it grew, you know, the next year, a few years, and then we had 3,000 people out marching, which is big for Louisville, against mm-hmm. the war by 71. That's how it was, you know, it grew everywhere. But, and a lot of that was happening there, and a lot of these kids who were deserting the army would come through there, and I remember one day this guy was sitting there, and he knew they were going to be looking for him, and so some cars pulled out front or something, and Steve Gilbert, and he went to prison later, too.
I've heard that name, too.
Yeah, well, I don't know what's become of Steve, but he was so calm, and I said, I think that's somebody looking for you, Steve. And he says, oh, shit. He went out the back door and just wandered through the backyards here. He got away from them, and he stayed. They didn't catch up with him for a long time. He may have surrendered later, and I think he went to prison.
Mm.
But some of them were just deserting. Some of them were going to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all around, plus then a lot of the stuff when the... after the bulk people came around, you know, and
okay.
after when the Black Six were indicted, a lot of the center of that activity for defending them. I mean, we had a huge movement in defense of the
actually,
Black Six.
Yeah, actually, the last thing I wanted to make sure to cover today.
Yeah, and you know, that was, and we were, and see, we had, that printing press was terrifically valuable because mm-hmm. people didn't have copy machines then, and we were doing the printing for everybody in town,
mm-hmm.
and we always had trouble finding somebody that would, and we had some pretty talented printers off and on,
mm-hmm.
who usually had come here from some other place, and because Skeff attracted people from other places too, and a lot of people did come, but there were a lot of people here too, and it became a center for that, and then the Panthers, when they organized, of course, by that time we had this building, and then we had a whole clash between us and some of the Black organizations, because we were white,
mm-hmm.
although we had Black, there were Blacks around, we were done, and so it was I think the government fomented some of that, and mm-hmm. so does this guy who's now in Cleveland, who's here, came down for that activism conference.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that. Ben Simmons, he's now Abdul Kahar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a whole thing. That was after Carl and I weren't directors of Skeff anymore, but there was a whole terrible situation between Skeff and the Panthers. And at one point, it was before JOMO, the Junta of Militant Organizations.
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
Which was more active here long before, before the Panthers. Claude McCollum, who's still around. Betty Baye was looking for him recently beyond this panel that she was having on this movie they had on Huey Newton that mm-hmm. premiered down here that I went
Claude
to.
Claude McCollum was JOMO?
He was with JOMO, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually took over this building for a while and wouldn't let us in. So it was a whole thing, but they finally did. There was a whole thing, but we sort of cooled that out without any open rift.
Mm-hmm.
With the Panthers, it didn't work out that way, but I think probably some people in Skeff handled it wrong, too, by that time. But anyway, it was a center of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, I haven't been able to find any of the people from, like, JOMO or the Panthers or any of the more militant groups. I had one name, and he said yes, and then we played phone tag for...
What was his name? Do you remember?
What was his name?
I think you ought to talk to Claude McCollum. He's around.
He's around.
And I tried to find him for this panel the other night. I don't know what he's doing. For a while, he was quite a leader in the 70s. After JOMO died, he was some of the stuff in the aftermath of the school busing, and when they were closing Black schools, he was out protesting that. Things around Shelby Lanier. He got fired about every
right.
year, and
yeah.
we'd have a movement to
yeah.
support him, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then he got very into cultural things, African, Pan-African culture kind of things, centered down at this Afrocentric Lutheran church on Broadway, which is now closed. I think it's closed. He had a bookstore there. I didn't see him too often. He was so active, but he just kind of almost, well, to me it looked like kind of retreating into just a cultural thing. But maybe it was what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But he would remember that, and he was very important in that JOMO thing, and also in the movements in the 70s. Yeah, and he lived right around the corner from me, and I think he still does, because I don't see him. Every once in a while I'd see him on the street. I used to run into him at 28th Street Post Office all the time. I don't know whether Claude ever joined the Panthers or not. He was in Jomo, and it was a little different year, and then you had 7 Panthers indicted. Mm-hmm. Well, have you talked to Bill Allison? Bill Allison was their lawyer.
Oh, no, that'd be great.
Well, he knows all about that. There were the Louisville 7. 7 of them were indicted, and they won the case. There was one went to prison because his case was a little different. Blakemore. I don't know what's become of Blakemore.
You've heard the name, though.
But I don't remember the other names. One is named Alexander, G.T. Alexander. Mm-hmm. He's still around. And did you talk to him?
No, I heard he was in Indiana. But
he is, but okay. He comes here every once in a while. Yeah, he would probably love to talk with you. And you can, you know, everybody's memory gets a little inaccurate, and he might have some inaccuracies, but so do I, probably.
But at this point, because that's a whole, I'm going to just put
part.
I do, too.
Because it was part of that whole thing, and I touched on it a little bit in the thing I did for the encyclopedia. There was a definite change in the movement, you know, that you got to take notice of. And it was less, maybe, massive in Louisville than some places, but it was happening everywhere. And I don't know what theories I'm not one. Historians are developing about it. Mm-hmm. I think it was more that generation of, not a generation, but things move so fast, the people who were quite young and black and came to maturity after the early 60s, you know, in the sit-ins and even the voting rights stuff, who I think were so heroic, those early people. I really do. I mean, have you seen this video that I've been telling everybody to see? But it's not about Louisville, but if you really want, I'd have people, if they want to know about the Mississippi movement, they have to see it. It's called Freedom Song. It's a story of
Macomb,
Mississippi. It was on TV.
Oh, it was great. I saw it.
Yeah,
I've
got it on video. I didn't see it on TV. But and I knew all the people in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Chuck McDew, and he came down for that. I got put Winburn in touch with him. He came down from Minnesota. A lot of them have dropped. He's teaching civil rights history instead of doing anything right now. But he's made his contribution, I guess. I wasn't sure which one he was. And I said, I think I know which one was you, Chuck, and I was right. But I knew them all. And the guy who played Bob Moses actually looks like him. It's amazing, But it's really, I mean, it just shows who changed the country, really, was those kids. I mean, even Bob Moses told them not to march to City Hall, you know, remember in the movie?
Well,
but they did.
I told my students that most movies that claim to be about the civil rights era are terrible movies. Mississippi Burning, for example.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, you know, this grew out of that, really.
But that one, I actually tell my students, if you want to watch a fiction, you know, a sort of a dramatic feature, not a documentary, that's the one to watch, because I think it's a really
good dramatizes
movie.
What happened. Yeah. That's who did it. And I tell the young people all the time, it was people 16 and 17 years old who basically changed the country. They just took their lives in their hands. And Chuck tells this story about he thought they were going to castrate him. And what he was doing, it was just a gruesome sort of story. Mm-hmm. They didn't. But he was, but anyway, but that's, that's not in the movie, but they were, you know, they were so idealistic, and they were ready to give their lives, and some of them did, obviously, for this vision of a new world, kind of in the beloved community and all that. And I think, and then the voting rights became a, you know, the whole thing that happened in SNCC of the almost broke up over the argument about direct action or voting, and how it all merged together in Mississippi and Alabama and places like that, because it was direct action. And then that, you know, it was, but I think then you had a whole another set of young people coming along after that. A little bit younger. And I think looked around at what had happened and couldn't see that much had changed. I think that's what happened. And began to form sort of new organizations. And we're taken with the idea of black power, which was a very positive thing, in my opinion. You know, and not like, you know, SCEF was probably the only interracial group in the country that came out publicly for black power. And we made statements and everything, lost a lot of financial support, too, from white liberals. But it was a very positive movement that was moving the country forward, really. It was that whole black power movement, and then its various expressions. One of them here was Jomo. Well, but Bulk first. Bulk was probably the first group that was sort of... and Charles Tackey, he may not even remember him how he thought then himself, but I think realized that was what the kids were looking for. Was just... And you know, and the other thing, it's often posed, and is somewhat in... was in the discussion that we had after that movie and the Newton thing, which is, I don't much think much of that movie. I don't have time to talk about that now. Mm-hmm. But for other reasons. But it wasn't so much violence versus nonviolence. It was more the change. And some of the people who had been active in the early 60s, of course, just faded right into this newer, more mm-hmm. militant thing. And it wasn't because there was, you know, mighty few people in the early 60s who really believed in nonviolence, quote, as a way of life, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was more whether you had any faith in the system or not. Mm-hmm. That it was that, and I think the turning point for a lot of people was the 64 Democratic Convention, when mm-hmm. they really thought it was going to work and it didn't, and that there was just, and also that was when the attacks on SNCC started, too, mm-hmm. after that, long before Black Power was shouted.
Mm-hmm.
And you began reading all these derived. Before, in the press, there had been these shiny-eyed children walking the dirt roads of Mississippi, and all of a sudden there were these evil forces. And it were the same people,
right.
But, you know,
yeah.
they were, President Johnson was livid about them. And, of course, Kennedy hadn't been too friendly either, Bobby mm-hmm. Kennedy, but he's seen that way now. But, and it was happening, and that they were disillusioned,
mm-hmm.
and that it was more... that the whole system has to be changed, sort
mm-hmm.
of thing, and mm-hmm. that and actually the early movement had some notion of that too. It was like we're going to build a new society, but it was very vague.
Mm-hmm.
But this was just you had to tear down the whole system, and it was sort of and a rejection of integration that really wasn't anti-white. It was pro-black, and it was that we don't want to be integrated into this sinking ship, and that's
right.
what this
yeah.
country is. And I think they were right. I think it's sinking right now.
Uh-huh.
You know, they really were right.
Uh-huh.
But and they were crushed. Of course, that's my theory, too, that the historians, we've talked about that before, I think don't deal with that, how that movement was repressed in the late 60s. It was
mm-hmm.
just massive, and it was massive here. But that's. But there was this big change that came, and it was significant here. In terms of by the time of the, you know, the Panthers were destroyed. Jomo, I don't know what happened to Jomo. And by the way, Joe Waller, who was the sort of leading figure of Jomo in St. Petersburg, Florida, that's where it was based. And I'm not sure if Claude would remember how they got in touch with it here, because it didn't have branches a lot of places, but it did here.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Waller's still in St. Petersburg, and somebody told me recently he was running for mayor down there, a very serious race. I guess he didn't get elected, but he had a good chance, so he's gone into politics, and he's still there. I mean,
uh-huh.
people dug in, and some of them, and kept organizing in different ways, I guess. But that was the bulk, and then Jomo, and then the Panthers, and around the Black Six. I mean, we had a mass movement to free
mm-hmm.
the Black Six, and we did. We
mm-hmm.
won that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were indicted, I mean, there was a... it was a huge reaction in the black community. And I remember the bumper stickers. I think I wrote about that somewhere, there was a rally called after they were indicted, and somebody, a guy named Eugene Robinson, I don't know what's
mm-hmm.
become of him.
He left town, too.
Oh, did he? Well, maybe he was run out. But I remember he got up, and he was talking about how they were, you know, they were going to do in these people, and he said, "Not this time, baby." And somebody made a bumper sticker, said, "Not this time, baby."
Uh-huh.
And everybody was driving with it, you know. And so it was a big movement, and then the case was, and that was built. Bill Allison was on that case. No, Bill hadn't appeared then. I'm sorry, it wasn't Bill. Bill didn't appear till about 71, but later. Mm-hmm. It was Bob Delahanty and Neville
mm-hmm.
Tucker and Dan Taylor
mm-hmm.
defended him. And there are pictures of when they were freed and everything. I've got, you know, that booklet, that I think I thought I showed it to you once, that the Alliance put out when Ben Chavis got out of prison and came here and spoke in the early 80s, we put out a booklet on the decade of the 70s. It had a lot of pictures with it, had cut lines and little pieces. I'll have to find that for you, Casey, because it had little things about some of the things that were happening. It was reminded me. It's got a picture of Ben Simmons, Abdul-Kahar, cooking eggs or something at the breakfast program of the Panthers
mm-hmm.
and all that kind of stuff. And they were, but the Black Six case was a huge struggle around because there was a big movement to free them. We got a lot of white people involved, and it was really a mass support in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
So they got the case moved to Munfordville because of the pretrial publicity, and then we had people down there organizing, and we'd go down, and then Mike Honey and Martha Allen, who had come
mm-hmm.
here with SCEF, were working on that. That was sort of one of the things they were doing, and they put out this mailing to everybody in the phone book before mm-hmm. the trial, and then they got indicted for, it's called embracery, that they were trying right. to influence the jury, and we had a big fight about that. They were actually in jail for a while. For a little while, we got them out on bond. Then it was bounced back to Louisville, and they were, you know, I can't remember whether the jury acquitted them or whether they dropped it for lack of evidence. But there was a huge march. I've told you about that march when we took over 4th Street, haven't I? And there are big pictures of that. And Blaine Hudson right in the front of the row. Yeah, and that picture's in that little booklet. But that was when it was on the first anniversary. Peaceniks, and George Edwards was one of the leading forces, and there were Susie Post was very active mm-hmm. by then. That's the whole story about her too. She was getting the ACLU involved in activity, and she, you know, and she was changing the face of the ACLU. She was a volunteer then, but she was directing it pretty much, or president of it. And she was trying to get the leading wire dog. She organized a lot of the. She brought Ben Spock here and a lot of that peace stuff. But anyway, they were organizing a march for peace. You see, it was right in the midst of the Vietnam War. The same day. They hadn't been in touch with each other at all. And it was just coincidence that here the people came, and of course a lot of us who were white were with the march from the West End, but the white people coming from the East End, and it was pure coincidence they met at 4th and Broadway. And then 4th Street was, so the Galleria was just a street right. all the way down mm-hmm. there going to the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they just came there at the same time. And literally took over 4th Street. It's the only time since I've been in Louisville that we've taken over a main drag.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had a permit or anything, hadn't asked for one. But you couldn't do anything about it because it was hundreds and hundreds of people. And nobody tried to stop us. First the blacks, it was mostly black from the West End, were shouting freedom. And the people on the white march were saying peace. And by the time we got to about Chestnut Street, they were saying, the blacks were saying peace, and the whites were saying freedom, and they were saying peace and freedom. Took over 4th Street, and I happened to find myself by George Edwards, who had these big arguments, because he didn't agree with Skeff coming out for Black Power. He was an officer of Skeff then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at George, and I said, George, what do you think about that Black Power now? And he said, mm-hmm. maybe you're right.
Mm-hmm.
So we went down the courthouse, and there's a wonderful picture that's in that booklet, and I've got the original somewhere, but I'm not, I think, or it may have been one of them I gave to the Human Rights Commission. Fill the courthouse square, but a bunch of people climbed Thomas Jefferson's statue and raised the black flag.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very dramatic. And so that was the background before the thing, and we kept going down to City Hall, meeting with people about that, about the case, and trying to get the charges dropped, and they finally were. It took about 3 years, but that was a real victory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we did not do nearly as well on the Black Panther case, mm-hmm. and there were 7 of them indicted, but they were eventually freed, and Bill represented them. 6 of them were freed. But that, and I've forgotten all the details of that. They were charged with, I think, robbery or something. But really, and this is that what they were really doing besides their breakfast program was they were trying to get the drug dealers out of the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't, and I am absolutely convinced drugs were deliberately put in the black community to quiet things down. And it did,
mm-hmm.
you know, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Destroyed it, but it's destroyed a lot of whites too, as the chickens have come home to roost, sort of. But they were trying, they were just beginning to come in. I mean, there's always been some drugs, but it wasn't like now. You know, it just wasn't anything like now. I mean, and you didn't have the crime and all that. Our kids used to leave their bicycles out all night long and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody worried about things being stolen. You left your door unlocked all night. And that's totally changed because of the drugs, basically. But they were just really, that was the beginning of the drug trade in the black community. And they were trying to stop it. And I think that the police were, I don't know what all they were doing, I don't know. But the police were tied in with the drug dealers, and they framed them on this charge. I'm convinced that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, you know, I've never even talked to Abdul about that part of it in recent years, and
mm-hmm.
can't even remember the details of the case. But it's a real important piece of the history. And as I say, I don't even remember what happened to Jomo. It finally faded away. Uh-huh. But although Claude continued active through the 70s and various things. I remember all the battles about Shelby Lanier, for example. Yeah. So you can surely get him.
I'll get
Abdul's. Call me tomorrow.
Okay.
And remind me, because I'll look for it tonight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to stop this now.
We turned a lot of those defensive battles into offenses, really. Mm-hmm. That's the way Black Six became that, you mm-hmm. see. And the Narvel Tinsley case, there was a big battle about that. We lost, and they went to prison. They finally got out. They were among the people who, and, you know, this woman we all know married Narvel Tinsley and all that. But, and they got off the death row when everybody did after that 72 decision, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, or maybe it was a little later. No, that's right. But there was a big battle about that, and Bill Kunstler was here, and he came here a good bit because he was worked with Skeff on a lot of things, so right. We had him here on various things. He was here on our 68 sedition case, too, 67, in Pikeville, and played a part in that. And, see, that was another whole thing. Of course, that was more in Pikeville, but that second sedition case. By the way, I talked about Vernon Robertson mm-hmm. and George Kimbrough. Both of them offered to put up their houses as bond for Carl and me to get out of prison. See, that was something courageous they did. But mm-hmm. we didn't want to get out. We said we wanted our bond reduced, and we got the law declared unconstitutional. And Bill came down and argued it, but that was in Lexington. But he was here on the Narvel Tinsley case, and then Dan got in prison for contempt or jail, and sent Bill a telegram because Bill was under indictment for contempt and got 3 years or something out of the Chicago case, and Dan got 4. He got out, you know, I don't know whatever happened, but he said, "We try harder," or something.
Was the Tinsley case that early? For some reason, I thought the Tinsley case was later in the 70s.
Couldn't have been much later.
That's interesting. Okay, because I had sort of. Remember, I heard the stories and thought, oh, but that's after.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they got off of death row some other way. They did get off of death row and finally got out, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there was somebody else I knew that had gotten a death sentence. That was another whole movement of the 60s that I forgot to tell you about. That the Gandhi Corps. Yeah, see, during this was 64. SDS were setting up these projects all around the country,
mm-hmm.
supposedly to try to organize the white working class to join forces with the blacks. It never was too soon. They had a big project in Newark and Cleveland, a few places, but they sent some mm-hmm. people here. A guy named Bill Dady, who lived at our house, and he's called me. He went to Ireland, and he calls me. He's got this Irish accent now. He called me sometimes in the last few years, and I haven't called him back. But he lived there, and he got to working with these young kids and formed this thing called the Gandhi Corps. He never did much with the white working class, but that was harder. So mm-hmm, they all mm-hmm. kind of reverted to the black community. He was white. But and some of them lived in the projects down there. They got very active, and in fact, my son got arrested with them. Jim didn't do this sort of thing much, but he did a few times. He got into the open housing thing finally a little bit. But they got arrested sitting in up at the Hazenaris, because even though the downtown had integrated, these outlying places hadn't. Well, we had a whole battle about Fountain Ferry Park, too,
right,
the same
yeah.
way, about the mm-hmm. same period. But the Gandhi Corps was a really good thing. These kids had really gotten involved, and they all were juvenile delinquents, had been in trouble, and this was the first summer that the only thing they got arrested for was something good instead, mm-hmm. you know. But they got so attacked and that some of the more... And all that Allied Organization for Civil Rights was going on then, they didn't much like these kids, and they didn't like their association with us, probably, but also they just were just not quite respectable. And so they got these various charges against them, and the thing was really broken up. It was really sad, and to me, and they had one guy, Father John Loftus, you might have run into him.
I've heard the name,
He was a Catholic. He's died, but they made him their chaplain. And he defended them, and he was more of a respectable voice. But that was a force. And this one guy, because later he got on death row, that's who I was thinking about, got off when the general amnesty or general decision from the court. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he was a really smart guy, and he was really going in the right direction. But after that broke up, he just sort of got in with the wrong crowd, and got into different things, and mm-hmm. shot a policeman or something trying to arrest him somewhere and got on death row. So it was... and all that. But that was, just a whole episode. It was just a few months in there, so I'd almost forgotten that one.
And I'd never heard of
and
them
then,
before.
Yeah, the Gandhi Corps. And then there was the whole student movement at the U of L.
Right, yeah. Blaine told me
that they took over the administration building. Yeah. Jerry Neal was a part of that. Have you talked to Jerry?
No, he basically was too busy. But Blaine told me the whole story.
Blaine was in that.
It's being typed as we speak.
Yeah, and SCEF organized support for them. I remember we had a meeting at the Unitarian Church, and I remember Jerry Neal spoke, and Jerry was in his young and militant days, and I thought he made a good speech. And I know Sterling, his father, called me up the next day because he said, "What did Jerry say last night?" And I said, "Well, I thought he made a good speech." "Well, I don't know," he said. And people have been calling him objecting to Jerry's. I guess he was talking bad about white folks or something.
Oh.
That was sort of fashionable then.
Uh-huh.
But they finally, a lot of the things that Blaine's doing now in the Pan-African Studies is what they were asking for then.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really...
That's kind of ironic that Blaine's ahead of it.
Yeah, more of a victorious battle than some of them.
Uh-huh.
But, and I think, and you mentioned, I'll finish with this, that people who, a lot of people came here to work for SCEF, you see, and we attracted, and some of them were nutty.
Mm-hmm.
We got SCEF grew so because our staff just, and we weren't, a lot of people just came and volunteered because we never had that much money.
Mm-hmm.
And people were working for subsistence and all that kind of stuff. But people just came and our staff got bigger than the board. And that was one of the reasons that I think the government really played on the differences and was able to break it up. I'm convinced of that. But it also became overwhelmingly white. It was after SNCC told whites to go organize whites. Well, that's what SCEF was trying to do, you see, and people came here. Some of them were real good, some of them were crazy. And I remember I called Jim Foreman once, I said, "Quit sending us all these crazy people." But some of them were good, and people came here for different reasons, and a lot of them have stayed, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot, not all. Nancy Gall Clayton, you ever heard of her? That's how she came here.
And I interviewed Ira Gruper, too.
And Ira came here that way. And there may be some other people still around that came here that way. But
they gave me, Nancy gave me two other names, but both men didn't want to be interviewed, so. I don't remember the one guy's name. The other one was Earl Williams.
Earl Wilson.
Wilson.
Didn't want to be interviewed.
Yeah, I can't remember why.
Well, I don't know why either. He's a strange guy. He's very active, though. He's moved over to Indiana. I saw him recently. He came here to work for SCEF.
Mm-hmm.
But he got very, very active. He and Nancy stayed good friends. And also Johanna Kamenish.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she mentioned that name, too. Yeah.
That came here for other reasons. She's a teacher, and she's a wonderful person. I love her. But they've stayed good friends. She didn't come to work for SCEF,
mm-hmm.
but she got involved with us with some things. And she and Nancy, and we get together at least once a year. They always take me out to dinner for my birthday. It's in July. We sometimes don't do it till November.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
We do. And I saw. And in fact, we did it just recently, for last year, over at Earl's. But he's recently been head of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's been active. I don't know why he didn't want to talk.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember now.
I don't know what he'd remember about
mm-hmm.
that period, but but he stayed, and maybe some other people.
But I actually have to meet my... Yeah.